And welcome to Doc Guidance. I'm Chris.
I'm Brian.
I'm Tom.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Professor McGonagall, also known as Moops. Hello.
Also known as Moops Magic. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
So, what's happening? Oh, not much. Just, you know, things are still same old in this wonderful quarantine world we've got going on. Which has literally one great upshot, which is that I can actually fucking get a podcast organized on a semi-routine basis after I know where everyone's going to be. At home. At home. At home. Not in a Japanese train station.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate.
So, James has come along with us to help us talk about Infernals. The new kids on the block. We'll be basically going through sort of an overview of the faction, the tips and tricks, that sort of thing. Tom, I believe you had a schedule for us that you came up with.
In a mild attempt to make this podcast like somewhat organized, I just thought we'd have a few like key talking points and then obviously in Dark Guidance fashion just waffle around them. So I thought we'd just start with a bit of an overview of the archetypes and tempo of the faction, sort of look at how it's playing. Talk about like what list pairings are looking like at the moment and how like staples function in the faction. Talk about like some key models and stuff like that for people that probably haven't got any experience playing against them or are starting to look at building lists for them. Then talk about what the faction is playing well into and what its problem matchups are. Sort of a bit of a snapshot of where it's at in the current meta. And then just start having to think of and a bit of a chat about where the future of the faction might be heading with how the way the meta shifts and how different types of lists are going to come to the fore. And specifically, I think it'd be interesting to have a bit of a chat about whether or not Hearts of Darkness is sort of flexible enough to give Infernals a bit of a leg up as the game changes around them.
I think this is the most organized we have been since like episode one when we wrote down what we're going to talk about.
No, I remember that class. That was not organized at all. That was like 4 hours, and then we realized, hang on, we're on a podcast. We were meant to talk about something.
Actually, fun flashback was the last time that Tom was podcasting from a Japanese bathroom was the last time that I wrote a schedule for this podcast. So I think
Chris
that would be our
last usually
attempt.
Writes one on the day.
Yeah, I usually do.
Does he though?
Following
he?
It is.
I do. I could take photos of them. They're not very in-depth because half the time they just prove like useless after a certain point.
I'd rather you
do. But it's fine. If nothing else, it reminds me what the classes in said faction are, what themes they've got, and obviously none of that is actually important in Infernals. When we say Infernals, right, we realistically almost always refer to Dark Legacy and the three Infernal Masters.
Wait, it's not Mordnebra.
It is apparently not Mordnebra. It is not Fiora 4,
doesn't
believe
count.
It or not.
She doesn't count in any of the factions she works for.
Regrettably.
Yes.
What a fall from grace. Mordnebra 1 used to be so cool.
What a terror in Mark 2. Like, I would have nightmares just... Like, my whole game plan was, if I don't die, like, if I can lose this game a way other than dying against a capable Mordnebra player, I've had a good time.
Yes.
It's pretty
I've
much
never seen...
not on a WTC team.
I remember seeing the Slayer, reading the Slayer stat card for the first time, and then having a Slayer, like, basically shoot out there and kill one of my Jacks. Fuck, the first game we had, Tom, was when you taught me an important lesson in War Machine, which is that you can ghostly and trample through buildings.
Yeah, it's enough fun.
I died. That was great. So, of all of us, James, you have, I'm pretty sure, the most experience playing as Infernals. A lot of us...
I think Brian might.
Brian would have had... Apologies. Brian has had a fair bit as well. So I think between the two of you, we have at least, two competent-ish Infernal players who can tell us sort of about the things, how they've noticed about the faction. So give us an overview and a rundown in your own words. I suppose.
Brian, after you.
Okay.
Go if you want.
No, I'm happy either way. Would you like to go?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So I by no means claim to be an Infernal Master myself.
yes.
That I'm only about a dozen or so games in them, but I fell in love with them the moment I saw them. I have a fully painted Infernal Army now, thanks to Josh Bates, the legend, and I have a Fiora 3 list that I'm sort of filling out at the moment. So I'm kind of all in alongside my Circle and Grimkin. Infernals, to me, they're really appealing as a miniature faction because I think they're very well designed if you want to get into the game as a new player and collect a limited army. Not because the mechanics are easy or anything, but just because they're a very self-sufficient army. There's literally three casters and realistically like a handful of models that you need, or different types of models to get into them. The three different casters have sort of three ends of the triangle, and they really complement each other nicely. And then you've kind of got expansion packs in terms of the Hearts of Darkness lists, which are the Fiora lists, the Sloan lists, the other casters who you can sort of think of as a, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 model expansion pack. So I actually think they're quite appealing to a new player. The aesthetic is beautiful. You can do some really crazy things with the models. Yeah, they're really appealing as a
the Masters
or even a second faction.
Yeah, the Masters all look fucking dope. Like,
yeah, and the models are sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian?
Well, I think you summarized it, like, incredibly well. They fleshed out a lot of the Masters in really unique ways, so they all play quite differently. They have a very unique mechanic, which is really interesting that they brought to the game. It's not quite as extreme as it was during playtesting, but nothing ever is. My thing is, for new players, there's something they need to be a little worried about, is that it's a very, from learning the game, if you're playing against other new players, it'll probably be very powerful. But if you're playing against really experienced players who know how the faction works, it can be really hard to get the ball rolling with this faction, because I feel like they have a real weakness early game, and if you can take advantage of that, that can be really hampering throughout the rest of the game. Because if they get put on the back foot early, that can be really hard for them. I don't think that's a reason not to play them, but I do think that is something to go into if you're going to play with a new Infernals player, is try not to push it in too early or it'll really hurt them learning the faction.
Yeah. Infernals, Infernals to me, one of the reasons I actually did want to do this cast is you read a lot of hyperbole on the internet, and especially in wargaming. And one of them is just, like, of how fucking brutal and busted this faction is and how crazy undefeatable it is. So, to summarize Infernal's mechanic, it can be really just summarized in one word, summoning. They have a mechanic where they deliberately sacrifice solos to turn them into giant monsters. And it means that, effectively, you have this kind of weird venture capitalism scheme going, and when it works, without your opponent, like, putting in, like, trying to stop it, then, by God, it works. You just get free fucking value, and it's oppressive as balls.
Yeah, but they can be really rewarding to play well. The other thing I'll say there, though, is I think they are really balanced around the sort of competitive 75-point level. If you're playing, like, zero-point games, you functionally cannot play. And there are a couple of core pieces. A lot of the lists are very similar across the board. So there are a couple of core pieces that you will need, but you might find don't function very well at the 0, 25, 35 point level. Having said that, if they can, they can absolutely snowball and be very polarizing. The other three thing I just want to touch on really briefly is the three casters, Agathon, Nomodamus, and Zadaroth. They really bring a diverse toolbox of things that they can do, complement each other really nicely in that they are very unique. One is a spell slinging tricksy, see your third eye in the matrix in Agathon. One is a real powerhouse of a toolbox in Zadaroth, and one is the heavy beat stick that maybe solves a couple of matchups and is fun to smash in Nomodamus. So as a standalone faction with a single theme, that they're still a force to be reckoned with, which I think says something to the sort of potential power level of them. And I'm excited to talk about where they'll go in the future. Because the current design is a bit bizarre in the sort of like same way that Riot Quest is a bit bizarre as well.
Mm. Well, they're very, very interesting. And it's really interesting to kind of plan out games because it's really hard because you have to really balance. So the biggest mechanic, as you said, is the summoning mechanic around the solos. And the solos are all really useful and powerful in most cases. So it can be really hard and very interesting to play the game determining which time you sacrifice which piece, as you're going to be losing buffs and other special abilities in order to make your list work.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that cannot be overstated, though, is that, at least in my experience, almost always games against Infernals, the end game may not look... The game is usually decided well in advance, either because the Infernal player gets like hamstrung early, as Brian alluded to, and then is constantly on the back foot, or the Infernal player absolutely snowballs someone because they got something early that they planned to have go off, and from there it's just they just bound pressure upon pressure upon pressure as their solos just start turning into monsters as they're no longer needed, and just all fucking works. When it works, it's like some fucking Ponzi scheme of just infinite value, but when it doesn't work, you have the IRS coming to collect your money, and you're just like, I need to kill my own army to stay in the game, let alone when your opponent is like trying to kill your own army as well. It's not exactly viable.
It is a delicate balancing act. Chris, you have this weird like tax analogy going on. I think you've played a game or two with them. Can you just tell me a little bit more about why you think this is the case, or is it actually just worth diving into summoning it in, as a whole?
I think it's worth diving into summoning as a whole. Like, it really is. It's like, you cannot get around how much this matters as a thing. Because let me be blunt. Imagine you played Infernals and you didn't summon at all. You just decided, I'm a better person than anyone else. I'm just going to, you know, not summon anything. Well, how does your faction then work? It doesn't.
Right. That sounds incredibly painful.
It would be extremely... The analogy I used back when I played it was that basically you're committing tax fraud, right? You're effectively... You're doing some weird borrowing shenanigans. You're borrowing from the future and you're using this... Because the way the Infernal mechanics work is... Summoning... First of all, Infernals, their mechanic, instead of being Focus or Fury, is Essence. Essence is... it's a bit of a weird hybrid of it, but the kicker of it is that in order to refill Essence, you either have to take damage on your Warcaster, similar to cutting with a Warlock, or you have to sacrifice a model. Usually, this is just a cultist, and specifically, by the way, it has to be a model with a soul, i.e. one you can't resurrect, otherwise it'd be kind of dumb. You'd sacrifice a Griever, the Griever then pops back out of the gate, and you're like, okay, cool. Low price of one soul. Let's get him.
Yeah, but the Griever requires a soul to come back, which I suppose is free with the gate, so...
The gate... exactly.
The gate usually has better things to do, though, but that's getting off point.
Exactly. So, the mechanic is... The faction is inherently self-destructive. Your primary mechanic... is basically once per turn, you can have an Infernal Master spend essence equal to the horror stat of a horror, and then pick a solo. That solo gets removed, and in its place, it spawns a horror with one essence point. Furthermore, at the end of every turn, all of your horrors are required to tithe one essence, apart from turn one.
Has Peter Bates paid tithe ever?
Yes. I've seen him play it. It was actually something we discussed when we were looking at playing Infernals, is that rules is written, if you forget to pay tithe, you just actually immediately lose, because all of your... Everything you forgot to pay tithe on just disappears. And that was something Batesy was worried about. Like, he was remembering it because he was mortally terrified of forgetting it, and of forgetting it at a big game. And that's one of the reasons... I found with... Infernals, personally speaking, and obviously this is my ones and twos of games of experience, there's a lot of fussy bookkeeping involved, and you've really got to know how your opponent can screw you over. Things like how your opponent might be able to shut down your allocation of essence for whatever means, or the fact that if Hermit dies near an Infernals army and you as the Infernal player killed him, you get absolutely dicked over. It's not even like close, just what happens. And things like
that.
The
Hermit, even when he doesn't die, can dick over your army.
He still is pretty good against it, yes.
He has an ability to just strip all the essence off models near, like one essence off each model nearby. Same way you can put it on your friendly models.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's just like, well, you want to kill that guy? Go for it. Go for it, man. You do that, you. Oh, look at that. all of your horrors just lost all of their essence, and also no one can cast spells within 8 inches of where Hermit died, meaning none of your cultists can put any essence back on him, and your Hermit also can't. Enjoy.
The mechanic's interesting, right? So, like, when I first looked at it, I just always thought that you should always go to turn 7 playing this faction, because you can, like, theoretically, right, you get to summon 7 heavies, and I just thought that, like, if you're up 84 points on someone, like, there's just no, like, it just boggles my mind, right? Like, if he goes to turn 7 and, like, you summon 7 heavies, like, I don't see, like, how you lose that game, right?
Yeah, but that's not, I don't know if that's how I, like, here's the thing, though, is, like, any game that goes to turn 7 as Infernals was decided well before turn 7, like, turn 4 or 5 at the tops, I usually find.
Yeah, so that's what turn, I observed at CanCon, which was, like, a lot different than what I thought was going to happen, because, like, a lot of games were just, like, in, like, turn 3 or 4, and just, like, 4 heavies exploded.
Yes. And...
But- if your 4 heavies explode, it depends on how many you've summoned throughout that game. Sometimes you can let that many explode and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, how many did Jack kill in that one game you played, Brian?
All of them. All of them. Everyone I started with, all of the ones I summon.
dead. Alright. So going into the, I guess you guys wanna go into the summoning mechanic in more depth, specifically the kind of things you summon and how it works.
We could. I don't know. If I feel like that might have been covered a few other places a few times. Just asking for maybe just a bit of clarity. When you guys are playing Infernals, how cognizant are you of sort of like your turns ahead as far as summoning goes? Like in terms of like learning this faction and in terms of the way that you process the way the game is going, are you finding that summoning is sort of like a set play, are you, like with a certain list, or are you finding like more often than not you're having to adapt on the go based on what's in front of you?
Good question, Tom. In my experience, you definitely have sort of like an order of play.
Yep.
So you really do need a plan. It is a delicate balancing act the whole game, and you do need sort of a plan to deal with how you're going to make the most out of your army. So there will be moments where summoning is actually not a correct move. Generally speaking, it is. But you kind of do need a pecking order. So understanding that a solo like Lord Roger, who actually allows you to summon in a guy without spending essence, is generally going to be most useful on turn where you want to be spending a lot of your essence stack or being able to camp aggressively, whereas it will generally cost you at least 3 to 4 if you've got a gate to bring in a heavy. So that balancing that, and that you will then need to fuel him likely with cultists and hermit, and then he will need to do work, and then you'll need to follow up. That constant balancing act is important. So for example, if you start the game with 6-7 heavies and 1 or 2 marked souls, you're actually probably really not going to be summoning, and the focus is going to be on how do I fuel my heavies. So a lot of lists sort of gravitate to this natural balance of, you know, 6-7-8 marked souls, and then making sure that you can fuel them properly.
Yeah.
I find that usually, especially your earlier turns, you have an order of operations for which solos you want to sacrifice in what order based on matchups. And that always comes down to matchups, for instance. The other thing, too, is it's a good thing you mentioned Lord Regate or Lord Regret, because I find he's basically an auto include, because effectively what he is he's a mini feat for your Warcaster. Oh, sorry, your Infernal Master. So that your Infernal Master gets their full essence to play around with that turn. And it's important because oftentimes, this is one thing with Infernals, if they are summoning, then their casters are basically treated as having 3 or 4 less essence that turn. And for a caster like Omidamus, no, he doesn't give a shit, right? It's Omidamus, right? He'll just do that happily. But for someone like Zadaroth, with such an amazing spell list, and even for Agathon, who might really need to put out a bunch of Hellmouths that turn, it is a problem when you have to time your use of Lord Regate really well, because also, if incidentally, when playing against Infernals, if you can snipe that guy out, it's it might not be apparent right away how much of a blow it is, but it will probably fuck up your Infernal's opponent at some point, especially if the game is anywhere near close. Because his turn is usually, I think, one of the biggest turns, and that's usually why I see him also sacrificed roughly around turn 2 to 3, when you need to have that blitz blowout turn, when you really need to, say, get a Warpath, or whatever Warpath is called in Infernals.
Rites of Torment.
Torment! To get a Tormentor onto your opponent's Colossal and put, like, the curse and, like, you know, Sighting Touch. And get all of that shit going on. Because you've identified that, man, if you can get that Colossal off the table, or even just get that heavy into that Colossal's face and pin it for next turn, the game's yours. It will take, like, 2 to 3 more turns. But, man, this is go time. This is go turn. Let's do it.
Okay. No, go ahead.
Okay, I was just gonna finish up then by saying, usually speaking, with Infernals, when you're summoning, you typically, I find a lot of times you use the solos, they go out and they do a thing to buff the army, and then they die. So typically, it's almost like their last hurrah, so to speak. So frequently, like, Eilish 2 goes out, throws out a Puppet Master on, like, the heavy going in, and then Gray bravely sacrifices his life so that he can become a horror. Like, you do that a lot of the time.
Yeah. Any turn where you're using them, you can use their normal activation and then have a heavy appear afterwards, which is saying, you can get maximum value out of it. It does feel really powerful and strong when you are doing not just that, but in general, switching a 4-point into a 12 or 13-point model. You get going plus 8 points each turn. And as a result, I think the faction is maybe a tad understated to compensate. However, when you've just got such mass and volume of essentially heavies, it more than compensates.
Yeah. Just to build off that point where, like, you're sort of indicating that when, like, you're committing your solos to do work, it's sort of like a one-and-done scenario. And James, you were sort of talking about it being a really delicate balancing act earlier. How do you find balancing use of solos and getting good work out of them in the turns before they're sort of destined to die? Do you feel like a lot of them sort of get held in reserve and then you're sort of waiting for their moment to shine? Or do you feel like the faction's actually been built with these abilities to sort of, like, coincide with a game plan and eventually they're sort of taken out of the fray to do something different for the army by becoming a heavy?
Yeah, good question again. There's a couple of ways of looking at that. I think one of the first things you do when you build a Infernal list is decide sort of how many heavies you're starting with. So therefore, by the time you get to turn 2 or 3, have you got 4 heavies, 5 heavies, 6 heavies, 7 heavies on the table? So what sort of impact are you having there? And then the game plan flows around that. The thing with Infernal solos as well, that they're all really good
bonkers
and useful.
Yeah.
They're amazing, right? So the ones that in my mind are almost auto-include in every list are, in Dark Legacy list, is Hawk, the Great Princess, Runewood, Hermit, and Roger Devaris.
Lord Regret, or whatever.
And realistically, and I'm actually thinking that Auron 2 is almost an auto-include, but I know that some people will call that heresy, Frawley.
he can be wrong. He can be 100% wrong. That guy is fucking busted-ish.
Yeah, in my mind, is incredible. But, like, so for example, that's a great example there. I like big moments. I like big plays. I really like assassinations. It's kind of just who I am as a player. It's how I made my mark in Circle. So to me, he really fits into my play style. Some games where you're going for a really long attrition, you might find you don't need him. You don't need Puppet Master because you're just over a massive attacks. You really don't need it. And he can be first to sacrifice. However, I'm actually finding most commonly, after I've included all those clutch solos who are doing a lot of work in turns 2, 3, 4, 5, that I haven't got many points left. And I've really got points for maybe 1 or 2 solos I can squeeze in. And at the moment, for me, that's Nissia and the Wretch. And almost every game, they are the first to go. I like the questions Nissia asks with her gun. But almost every game, the Wretch goes first. Unless he's got a great application for Entropic Force or whatever. So,
well, actually, go on, actually, Tom.
I was just going to say, like, I think the Wretch is a real, like, just to sort of interject, I think the Wretch is a really well-designed solo for the way this faction works, because he's such a sort of amazing sometimes suitability, like in the scenarios where he is applicable and you want that Entropic Aura, like it is fairly matchup defining. And then other times he's actually just designed as the guy that dies first. I think that's actually kind of a mark of good design.
His type of piece. His stealth ability is, I find, by far, like, the most dangerous thing he's got going for him. And then, yeah, sometimes he walks, throws out an ancillary attack on, like, a Vomit Hand so that the Vomit Hand applies a debuff, repositions in to get Entropic Force, you activate your heavy and does its thing, and then finally you just end with the caster and he pops the wretch into, a crab hands or something, yeah. And you're just like, wow.
And like, this that's was a little nuance of how these guys are designed, right, as well. With all the solos in this theme have Repo 3, so they can often do their thing, and then Repo 3, so Walk 6, Repo 3 is 9, and then he has an Entropic Force. So he has a 14-inch Entropic Force without threat, without actually compromising on any of his own value to use his magic abilities, as opposed to running 12 and Entropic Force for 5 for 17. So I actually played a game, I think it was last night or the night before, against Abby 1, who... feated, and her feats gives her battle group rapid healing. And I was like, I probably shouldn't have sacrificed my wretch turn one. Like, that you really need to, you will be rewarded for knowing more about your army and their army, and therefore sacrificing your marked souls in a different order. That's like a little skill knowledge thing that you can work on.
Personally, I find the wretch is one of the most useful solos, and they tend to be one of the last things I sacrifice. I usually give up Runewood because the reason I usually end up bringing him, unless it's in a very niche case, is just for the plus one to go first. So he's usually one of the first things to go. And while getting rerolls and stuff and support for the army is nice, I find that the wretches are much more flexible than Elish or Elish 1 or Elish 2, who are great solos and incredibly powerful. But I find that the different ways you can apply a wretch usually ends up making those guys go below them on the list of requirements. I find wretches incredibly strong, and I try and get them in as many of them I can in a list, because I find that they're one of the most flexible pieces, as we've been just mentioning, of all the things you can take. I think only like Regna and Roger are above them, and maybe Hoke, depending on the list I'm playing.
Good call. Like, another little thing with the wretches, using ancillary attack on a desolator that you've just summoned, and then in the desolator's activation walking it back out of threat range. So that little got a lot of cheeky little applications, and I definitely don't blame you for sacrificing Runewood first one early on. The ones I don't compromise on ever are Regna and Roger. Those two are just auto includes.
I have
a question about a solo that's semi controversial. Umbral Guardian.
Yes. So Umbral Guardians, I think, are part of this list. In fact, because you've got so many squishy support solos, they're not even squishy sometimes, but realistically, they're so important, though, that Umbral Guardians are one of the things you add into this list in order to stop your opponent from just trivially sniping them and thus accelerating your game clock. The Umbral Guardian, for those who don't know, is a medium-based solo that effectively can start the game off the board. And whenever you declare whenever you shoot an infernal model and you hit with the attack, you can just have the Umbral Guardian pop out as if it was there all along, and it will take the shot.
That's why.
The ability is called Shadow Guardian. It is commonly called Shadow Guard. Furthermore, this model...
Chris, you're reciting stats now.
Okay, fine. Well, I was just going to say it. fine. Go for it.
I think Dimmy... I'm watching a game at CanCon with Dimmy and Bates, I believe it was, had a really good summary of what these guys are, which is, like, Dimmy shot at a model, they popped out, Dimmy being perplexed, asked what it did, and his summation of it at the end of that was, huh, so they're like imaginary shield guards. Which I feel is actually like a pretty good way to put it.
Dimmy. You're a genius, Dimmy.
Like,
there's one or two layers on top of that, though, because they can absolutely put a wrench in any plan, as they can you place them anywhere within three, so they can block a charge lane, block line of sight, anything like that. They can really be more than a shield guard. And then on top of that, after they pop out, they are also a shield guard.
that was what I was trying to get into. Yes.
Yeah. It's completely within three. It's not actually within three. It's a little less distance than you think. which is a little annoying because sometimes you're planning it out and then, like, against Lord of the Feast, they're not super useful.
Yeah, that's yeah. Well, this is part of it, right? Is like when you're playing into Infernals, you do have to account for the fact they usually bring, generally speaking, at least one Umbral Guardian. Sometimes with Zadaroth, they don't. They just don't bother because Zadaroth has native protection herself. We can go into that later. But, you know, you just got to think about, like, what are the ways, like, you'll get fucked by an Umbral Guardian and how to unfuck it. AoE 5, also a good answer to Umbral Guardians, because that means where you still clip the original target with the blast. Other things, too, yeah. There's a lot of nuance to this, surprising nuance to an Umbral Guardian as a model.
I try and take one because of how annoying they are. Because it makes your opponent play around them to such a degree, because there's usually one or two guns in your opponent's army that are incredibly powerful, and if those don't trigger when they need them to on certain turns, can be incredibly bad for them. So just to have one in your list can make it very iffy for them.
Yeah.
It's usually a good way just to play the opponent.
Absolutely. Yes. Having played Storm Raptors recently, I would hate to see them on the other side of the table. For me, there are sometimes food because as Infernals essentially have transfers like Hordes, I'm used to sort of camping the right amount. And so they just add that extra sort of level of insurance.
Yeah. That's fair.
I find them more useful in Hearts of Darkness than I do in Dark Legacy. But again, I like just them for the fuckery.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. I played one of my first ever game against Infernals was Andrew Hayden with Agathon, and I was playing Wormwood, and we both had double Hellmouth. And I was like, okay, I've got this really nifty double Hellmouth on the table. And my mannequins went up to clear a path. Umbral Guardian popped out and said, hello. And I'm like, oh, this is awkward. So then I just boosted a roll of 16 and killed the Umbral Guardian. But still,
never in doubt.
And this is why they pay you the big bucks. Fucking tactical genius. So we have been saying roughly just saying heavies and heavies and heavies. You're summoning heavies all the time. I actually think we should probably go into the Infernals like category of horrors, even their non-heavy things, because it's actually kind of telling. When this faction was first sort of announced, they were like, oh yeah, these heavies are going to be a little understated compared to like the usual run of the mill. And then what we ended up with, especially after they decided to change the summoning mechanic from its original incarnation, which was basically like you got to Gaspy 2 feet every turn with a heavy. Instead, they're like, after they reworked it and they added all the... They put the movement tricks instead on the Warcasters and they did all this other shit. You got it in... And they kind of put a few buffs on these heavies and then they threw it together and threw it into the wild. And then now you've just got these giant heavy bricks. I think it's because it's such an integral part of this. I think we should probably go into like, especially at least the three main heavies that the Infernals tend to summon, how many they usually take main deck, i.e. like they basically buy, and how many they usually tend to like, you know, just summon, and what exactly they'll summon them for. So we can't really talk about Infernals without talking about the Lord of all heavies, the fucking Crab Hands himself, the Tormentor.
Well, I mean, he's your meat and potatoes. He's generally, I would say, the best choice to summon, unless you usually bring in a Desolator at some point just for the debuffs, or you bring up more depending on the situation. But generally, your meat and potatoes summon, in most cases, is the Tormentor, because I feel like you get your most value for bringing him onto the table.
Yeah, and that's a bit... maybe counterintuitive or doesn't make sense at the moment because he is the cheapest of the three heavies as well, but it's for a good reason. He's just the most efficient beat stick, and in a game of numbers, there's something to be said for having really efficient cheap numbers.
Yes.
Yep.
This has also been the source of endless jokes about basically you compare any infernal horror to like a Legion War Beast. Look at the Infernals, you look at the Legion Warbeast, you're like, why do I have to pay for this Carnivian? It is like two Tormentors, and worse than both of them.
Yeah, and what's going on? You're wrapping your head around what Infernals do, and you kind of look at the Tormentor, and he's quite basic. He's an 11-19 Isle of Side, 9-inch threat PS17 guy who will punch you lots, etc. But then when you have that moment, you're like, oh, wait, they get them for, like, quasi-free. Like, they just bring one in for pseudo-free every turn. It feels unfair. Like, even without summoning, their stats and their rules feel reasonable for 12 points. So
you would 100% run this in Legion just as that. Like, yeah, you would probably run it in a lot of factions as, like, a heavy.
Who knows?
Well, it's not just a basic beat stick. Like, if it was 12 points and had those stats, you'd probably still pay for it. Thing is, you get, like, three special rules on top of that, not including magical weapons and Isle of Sight. Mm. You get countercharge, which is fucking amazing, especially when you spam these motherfuckers and then take Hoke where they just countercharge through each other. So it gets kind of gross sometimes. Snacking, so they have a healing mechanic. So if they do not die, they have a method of healing back up without input of your master. And they have chain attack rabbit smash, which means they actually have a third initial if, as long as you're hitting everything.
Yeah, this
that's
is in
Mat 7, which is incredible as well.
Yes.
And then just to top it all off, they're steady. Actually, all three heavies are functionally steady. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of less important on the account of the fact that Hulk usually is around. But, I mean, the reason Hulk is actually around as much as he is because of the Tormentor and the countercharge being so strong. Like, Tactician Hulk, incidentally, is the Fallen Knight. He's the guy on the horse. And he gives all your models basically Tactician. Now, he's Tactician...
Faction Tactician.
Yeah, ridiculous.
It's very
strong. What do you guys call him?
At 12 inches. Or is it 10?
I just call him Fallen Knight because he's just got, like...
Arthas?
Yeah, Arthas. That's also... that also happens.
He's a 10-inch, my bad. Sorry.
That fucking guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So going back to the Tormentor, an incredible summon. The reason, I think just to address your initial point and how we got into this conversation, Chris, why do you summon heavies? It's because there is almost no disadvantage in doing so. So the cost of summoning a heavy is you sacrifice a Mark Soul. Sorry, summoning a horror is that you sacrifice the Mark Soul regardless. So no matter what, you are paying that half of the equation. And then you take essence off your caster. The lights are three essence. A pop, and the heavies are four. So you are paying one essence for the difference between a 7-point light and a 12, 13, or 14-point heavy. The math just works out such that these guys are the number one contender. The last thing I'll say about them is they're not really elegant. They're not classy, the Tormentors, but they do have a lot of useful rules, such as Isle of Sight, such as magical weapons, such as open fists, all really useful things that come up. One last thing about the Tormentor as well is, I don't know if you guys know this, his chain attack, he has a 1-inch melee on his crossing claws, but chain attack is only 0.5 inch across the board for heavies. So if you are between 8.5 to 9-inch threat on your opponent, i.e. you're out by 0.5 inch on the chain attack, you will not be grabbing and smashing. Fun fact.
Did not know that. Sucks. Oh.
There you go.
Also,
I feel so bad.
Yeah, fun fact about Infernals, there's no reach with in the heavies department.
Mm. Mm. And on a caster like Agathon, or even... Yeah, no, Agathon. There is no way to give them Pathfinder. Yeah.
Yes.
That is a significant sort of thing that you can do in preparing. Like, if your caster is behind a wall, you're probably safe.
Yep.
If you're playing against certain masters, yeah.
Yeah, without agnostic of the masters, yeah, for sure. Do you want to just talk about the summoning the other guys for a second? So basically the Soulstalker and the Desolator?
Definitely.
Very, very rarely summon a Soulstalker. I usually start with it on the table, but very rarely have reason to actually summon it.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. In collecting Infernals, I have... two Desolators. Actually, I have three, but that's a mistake. I should have two Desolators, two Soulstalkers, and eight Tormentors.
There you go.
I Those have are similar, but I think I also have three Desolators.
Yeah.
And I hate their fucking arms. They are cancer.
But before we talk about Desolators, we're talking about Soulstalkers.
Yeah, Soulstalkers. I really rate and love the Soulstalker. So a couple of things that I think it trumps the Tormentor on. There's a natural speed 7 over speed 5. So that's huge. It's really fast, especially if you're starting with one in a list. Not that I'm advocating that, but it can get further up the table than a Tormentor. It has much better defense, 13 instead of 11. So when you couple it with things like Zadaroth's feet, it is now at def 16. Jumping from a difference of def 14 to 16 is huge. And then adding in things like Lamenters, your Quasi def 18. So it's natural def and arm. Armor is obviously the downside, but there are ways to capitalize on its defense. It's one less mat, but it does have coil, which allows if you hit with one critical attack, it's then you're hitting with everything else. So in a faction where you can easily apply curse, give it rerolls, give it puppet master, a bunch of things, sometimes this can actually be a big saving grace. And then it has inherent stealth, which again really helps it with a bit of survivability and moving around the table. It does have Pathfinder, so that's huge over the Tormentor. It's Serpentine, so it basically things are not being knocked down in Infernal Army anyway, so realistically this is just a downside that it's not slamming or trampling. But then finally, and I quite like this ability on it, it has a rule called Soul Claiming where if a living enemy model is destroyed within four of him, your Infernal Master gets the soul. So I actually played a game the other day against Matty G where this guy picked up six Battle Mage souls, and I had a 13 Essence Zadaroth turn the following turn, which was absolutely glorious.
Okay.
All right.
I've played the Soul Stalker, and I agree. Like, if you can get Soul Claiming off, it's a real fun game. Problem is, in the current meta, it's a real hard time collecting souls.
Absolutely.
Like that one rule, which makes it like really like may consider putting it on the table. And it does have a lot of other niche rules, but in terms of like an attrition game, I have a harder time fitting him in because his basic POW 15 and his second constricted rule being 13 and only being reach one means it's like really hard for him to sometimes collect those souls and kill or even kill a heavy. But going back to the soul claiming, with the amount of anti-soul collection in the game right now, it can be real difficult for him to get value. Also, the amount of models that are undead or constructs right now.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Just like
in a faction without summoning, you'd probably never see this guy because his value is in his utility and his situational usefulness. However, the faction has summoning, and therefore I think he's a beautiful choice 10-20% of the time.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, I was going to say, first of all, thank you for liking the snake, because I've had to put up with Frawley just shitting on the snake all this time. Like, I find that's specific... Oh my god, what a fucking thing. Like, the important... I think you've sort of basically said why the snake is important in a couple of things. First of all, this guy is super good in Zadaroth. I actually find he's worth some... He's generally speaking the thing you'll summon turn one. You probably won't summon a Soul Snake on further turns. You'd start doing Desolators and Tormentors, typically speaking. The reason you have the Soul Snake, the reason you might even think about main decking the Soul Snake, like just taking it in your list to start the game with, even though it costs you one extra point, is specifically because he gets you that first... He is the first guy going in, he gets you the best board space, and he interacts so beautifully with Rites of Torment. Specifically being able to just like hide behind terrain and then Pathfinder through it. No bullshit required. You don't need an objective. You don't need some other shit just getting in the way. You can use Soul Snakes as board control pieces, because effectively what you'd say is, all right, if you go around here, this is Snake Forest Town, don't go here. And if I can get any kind of trigger off of Rites of Torment from any other means, then that snake's going through the forest, it's going to probably get a bunch of buffs from something, and it's going after one of your things. And maybe that gets a Tormentor down the line, or maybe it gets another Desolator spray, that sort of thing. It just starts compounding really quickly. But yeah, the other rules of it, like, frankly, Soul Collection and Era, where basically everyone and their dog is taking two Archons, is probably not that big a deal. But the other things it does, you shouldn't write off the snake. I find it's primarily a Zadaroth model. I probably could guess it sees some play in Agathon, but I'm not going to really quote on that. And Obedamus has no need, want, or frankly interest in taking a Soul Snake. If he was taking cheap synergy guys, he'd probably just take the light. You could summon one, I guess, just because it's a little faster. And at the end of the day, a synergied Soul Snake is probably going to kick about as much ass as anything with triple synergy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of. It depends. If it's the first thing, if it's the fastest thing in your army, it's usually the thing to start the chain, which is the problem.
Yeah. As opposed to the one to finish it. As I said, like, Omodamus, like, something it would be, like, that would be the extreme sometimes food. But on the other hand, it, like, fits perfectly with what I think Zadaroth wants. And, yeah, again, if you can actually get some soul value off of that, you're just, like, printing money.
I think the Soulstalker is what Zadaroth wants to take, but I don't think it's an always food. It's a very much a sometimes food, even for her.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So how about the Desolator?
Oh, man. Vomit hands.
I think you usually summon one most games, at least.
I've seen this guy summoned as a caster protective mechanism, as a board control means, as a way of being summoned and then ancillaried by a wretch to get a debuff onto a colossal. The Desolator for a guy who literally spews bile at people is really quite flexible and also kind of interesting. He's effectively a... he's very similar to a Crucible Guard suppressor, in that he sprays debuffs on you. He does actually do damage, but he is not going to do comparable damage to your mainline heavy, right? So Desolators and Tormentors are almost rather similar, but not really at all to like Tauros and suppressors. Desolators, generally speaking, you will almost never take this guy in like your main army list, because frankly those 2 points can very quickly be used for something more useful, just anything really. But that's okay. Like he's definitely one of those ones where you put him on the table at a certain point, you have an intent for him, but even then otherwise you take him. I will note that he is fucking, if Salt Claiming is on the table, then by God, even him with Omodamus is hilarious, because everyone that dies to that spray gets hoovered up as a soul. Everyone. And that can be some disgusting number of models, because normally soul claiming stuff is on like melee attacks and within 2-inch range. This guy assaulting and then spraying down a line of infantry. If you have garbage infantry and they manage to snipe out your Archon, you might be in for a bad time.
Yeah, the Desolator for me, he just really has a couple of primary functions. Number one, there's an advantage to summoning him in. Yeah, you can create a cloud, so a defensive bunker on the go. Also, strangely relevant for the Avatar matchup, you can block line of sight for the Avatar so you don't get gazed. Well, sorry, he cannot see you through the cloud, but you have Isle of Sight, so you can see him. Secondly, really benefits from Black Spot with Zadaroth, so you can have 4 Rat 8 sprays. His main job is actually he just helps where you have armor issues.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's him in a nutshell for me.
Yeah,
he seems pretty tactical summon.
Yes, he's very much the one you summon on the table when you need a specific thing. Now, I want to get into the lights real quick, especially because one of the solos we've alluded to a bunch is Princess Granovi, who effectively is your lesser war caster, and she's a beast, and she cannot summon heavies, but she can summon a light. She doesn't have to sacrifice a model to do so either. And so it's important to know what lights exist, but also sometimes that you might want to have these lights being your main Infernal Masters battle group for various reasons. So the two lights the Infernals have access to are the Lamenter and the Shrieker. The Lamenter is the one with the scything claws, and the Shrieker is the one that shriek. It's the one with the gun. And the only model without eyeless sight, it's got True Sight instead.
Because it has eyes, other models have eyes.
It has all the eyes, apparently. It's like nothing but eyes.
Yeah.
So. Oh, go on.
There you go. No, it's fine.
Okay, fair enough. So are the Shrieker, because it's the one you'll see the most often. The Shrieker has an amazing gun. Like, let's just not forget this. It's range 10, power 13, and has Admonisher, which is the thing that happens whenever you get shot by, like, Severius or any of those other effects. D3 nearest models take hits, power 10s. And the reason this thing, it's on a very cheap chassis of 0 points when you take it with Granovi. And otherwise, it's just, you know, it's something that might show up in your Warcaster, your Infernal Masters battle group that you would have started the game with. And it just, as a gun choice, especially when you start doing things like adding Desolator sprays in as well, it's fucking great. I find personally that before I forget that, it has another extremely important rule. It's got wailing, so it can run if it matters, and frequently people will forget this rule exists on this model, because it's a shrieker, it's a gun piece, so you can have this guy get stuck in to try and, like, complicate things, mess things up, deny orders. This is important as well, because Infernals are actually really capable of just laying weird, intricate traps of overlapping models and countercharge vectors because of Fallen Knight giving everyone tactician. So you can have this guy just run to deny, like, charges to, like, a unit of Weapon Masters, and then have the Shrieker itself covered by tacticianing, countercharging Tormentors, so even if they do try and get to your Shrieker to kill it, you can get something in there to block for it. This is really, really flexible, and again, you will see this model almost always summoned by Granovi. There's no real reason not to. Anything else you guys want to add?
Just really quick on whatever you call it. Princess Regna, her summoning mechanic is different. She doesn't have to sacrifice a Mark Soul. She just does nothing.
Gravenoid. She just puts
one light in base to base with her, and off she goes. So
she has old school summoning mechanics
for free. Yes. Yeah, she's stunning. She's just everything that you want in a model. So you'll often see this guy probably 80-90% of the time, and then the Lamenter the other occasional time where you're looking to stack death buffs. Again, Zadaroth jumps to mind because the Shrieker makes really good use of Black Spot in infantry clearing. If you need your lists are quite often really heavy focused, and therefore they don't like dealing, you know, with swarms of, you know, Banes or whatever. So having that option is really good.
Plus, yeah, it's a very good way of triggering Rites of Torment. Like, one of the best ways. Like, personally, when I ran Zadaroth, the times I dabbled in this faction, I actually had the Shriekers on. I had, like, at least one Shrieker on Zadaroth herself, if the points worked out, because being able to warpath a Shrieker was also just really good for chaining some kind of torments and stuff. Yeah, you can do a lot of things with this cool guy. He's really cool. Just keep in mind he exists, and you're seeing a lot of him. He gives you a nice, like, just toolboxy shooting gun, which is also just really good.
One of the good things about taking her with Zadaroth is, as you said, the reposition, because it can turn his 10-inch gun into a, I'm 13 inches away from my enemy now.
Yes.
So you can protect them from reprisal that way, which is a pretty useful ability, considering how squishy they are at 13-13.
Yeah, just really relevant utility. Wailing and a good gun.
Yeah, he's a mad guy.
Mad guy.
The gun is so good.
Fuck, I remember. Lamenta, just to finish things up, he's kind of, as James said, basically all about stacking soul parasites with some of the shit. Really annoying.
Zadaroth's feet.
Yeah, really annoying on Zadaroth's feet turn.
The reason there being, it's quasi plus 5 death in some situations, and if you miss, you blink. So even if you think you hit, you've got a decent chance of hitting, your opponent can blink away, and it's happy days. Just real quick, again, he's quite cheap for a light. He's only 7 points, so he has a lot of uses.
Yep. And then the final model to cover would be the Forboder, which is pretty simple. It's their Arknode. Because of some shenanigans, it did break the game for a while. So you can't. It's a bit of a shame you can't summon these off of a model and then immediately arc through it. But then, given that what people were doing with said mechanic, right, I don't feel that bad.
Yeah. So the Forboder is essentially a 13-10 Arknode. Just really worth noting that. This is actually quite good on Regna as well, where her lights don't have a job, aka into Menoth. The Shrieker's gun is generally pretty useless into Menoth. The Lamenter generally doesn't do too much into Menoth, is what I found outside of specific situations. And therefore, a Forboder allowing Regna to arc a Dark Guidance. That's this
part. Dark Seduction
is a really clutch little thing that she can do. So don't write him off. I would never, ever recommend summoning this guy. You're swapping 4 points, a 4 point solo for a 4 point war beast.
James, maybe you use a five point solo instead, because you want to make things fair for your opponent, right? So you, like, degrade yourself a little. build up some credit. We'll
trade Val and Hawk for a promoter.
Having said that, there are some situations where you can summon them for zero essence. You do have to spend the life soul, but zero essence if you're near a gate. And therefore, I've seen a caster in bunkers leave the zone on their own end, but they leave behind a foreboder that they've summoned to go and cap a flag to win the game. That's pretty cute.
That's some... I love that. That's good. That's,
if it wins you a game, then anything's worth sacrificing.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Granovi. You're now an Arknode.
the irony. Just don't make sure your other... the beast that she was holding was not contesting or scoring for you.
Yeah, that would be really awkward.
True. Do you tithe before you score scenario points?
I'm yes. Sure you do. Yes. You do. Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's very, very important.
So don't leave them on zero either.
No. Again, like, just if there's one thing you cannot forget as an Infernal player, the tithe. Just don't forget it. Because, first things first.
At least I mean, the hilarious moment.
You will forget it, and... yeah, the consequences are dire. Like, if you're in a friendly game, you can roll that back. And frankly, even in a tournament game, it's going to be a very weird one where they're just going to, like, yeah, just take the fucking thing off. But tithing...
The foreboder is just not a useful thing to summon. Just ignore it. It's a one-use Arknode. Use it like that.
Yep.
Take about 2 to 3 with Agathon, probably. Take one with Zadaroth because it's really useful. Otherwise, that's fine.
Yep. All right, should we move on to some of the other stuff we're going to talk about tonight?
Excellent, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. Okay, so... why is Kara Sloan the best Infernals caster?
We'll get there.
In just a sec, Tommy. So, from a list-building standpoint, James, you've also got like the most amount of experience for this faction. But I know, Brian, like you've been playing them a lot too. Whereabouts are you starting with like list pairs and is there like a reach to staple? Like, are you finding that like all pairs are based off like one caster, or if you start with a caster, you have to go in a certain direction and that dictates which themes you're taking? Like, what sort of complexities are you finding in the list building process for this faction?
Yeah, good. Another good question, Tom. You're on fire.
Mate, questions are fucking on point tonight.
The way in which you design an Infernals list, I have found, is very different to any other faction. They realistically, you can play them as they have one theme, which is Infernals, right? So your options are immediately limited, and there are, because of the essence and summoning mechanic, there is really sort of, I would say, an optimal-ish way to play Dark Legacy outside of a few cute things that you can do. Just in terms of raw value and numbers output. So, therefore, because you're only really looking at one theme, you would expect your casters to be a bit more rounded and all-comer-ish.
Mm.
I would say that Zadaroth seriously has game into almost the entirety of War Machine and Hordes, unlike almost any other caster in this edition. That's a pretty massive claim, but she kind of has to. She kind of has to, or otherwise the faction isn't balanced. If you are going to a tournament and you can only take 2 out of 3 of these casters, and let's just say hypothetically each caster was good into a third of the game, you're like, well, I hope I can dodge a third of the game because I can't bring that third infernal caster. Fortunately, Privateer Press have done a good job here in that I feel like Zadaroth has game into almost everything. Agathon is asks a tough question, and Onodamus shores up a few weaknesses. The lists are functionally very, very, very similar. So as a result, for me, like, yes, there are some nuances in how many heavies you take. Are you taking a gate, etc.? But at the end of the day, you're starting the game with somewhere between 2, 3, and 4 heavies, and hopefully ending it with north of 5 heavies. Unless the attrition doesn't go your way. That's really generally it. So as a result, I find myself going, pick any 2 out of 3. I have a personal preference for Zadaroth and Agathon because they're more tricksy. But Omidamus, I'm quite enjoying finding his layers and the tricks that he can do as well. So as a result, you could just roll a dice and happily take 2 out of 3 of those casters along.
Yeah, cool. Are you reaching much for the Hearts of Darkness option?
I've only really sort of recently started going into Hearts of Darkness because I really do think that you can view them as expansion packs to Infernals. Sure. So again, another one of the reasons was for the OTC, the Oceanic Team Championships, we were contemplating having two Infernal players on our team, myself and Andrew. However, with only three casters, three Infernal Masters, you must take Hearts of Darkness if you want to do it. Yeah. And one of the two units that we haven't spoken about that I would say are underplayed or not as useful in Dark Legacy Infernals are Howlers and Grievers. Grievers are not my favorite thing, but Howlers, they get a lot more mileage out of the Hearts of Darkness casters.
Yep.
So where I've landed with Hearts of Darkness is Fiora 3, just because I need 10 models to put together that list. four Choir, Sevi Zero, Fiora 3, Judicator, Dervish, and two Champions of the Order of the Wall. So it's 10 models, and I've got a fully functioning Hearts of Darkness list that I quite like. Cool models like Judicator. Oh my god, who the
fuck? Champions, man. Like, what a cool sculpt. Like,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And there's cool opportunities to paint and sculpt them up as sort of like evil, infernal esque Menoth. So, and hey, I don't want to go and buy a full Menoth army, but do I want to buy a Judicator and a couple of other models? Hell yeah. So, what does it
mean? Even better.
That Amadeus or someone doesn't, I'm actually really not sure, other than you get to put your Howlers on the table, which is enough of an appeal to me.
Like, that is actually... go on, sorry, Tom.
Just a quick question. Are you finding it feels side-grady, down-grady, or sort of just a bit weird combination of the two?
I would say that this list sort of asks a tougher question in terms of... you can be a bit more experimental into something when you can start really delving into the depths of War Room and things you're not familiar with. So, for example, Sevi Zero, in Hearts of Darkness, every model is an Infernal model. Yep. So, Eye of Menoth works on Friendly Faction, therefore works on Infernals. So now suddenly you've got a... you've got
Howlers
from Insight and Eye of Menoth and all these crazy things. So it does sort of... encourage the wacky scientist in you to go and find the other crazy things that work. It's just a way to branch out. And just from a business standpoint, I think it's a clever way for them to hopefully sell models that already exist and maybe are just sitting on some shop shelves and wouldn't see the light of day otherwise.
Yeah, more places to put more Never in, and maybe someone might be tricked into playing.
There you go.
It's also attractive to people that already own those factions, right? Where you're saying that Hearts of Darkness is like an upgrade pack or an expansion pack for Infernals, where Infernals could also be an expansion pack for Cable, Metal, Signar, and Krix.
Well, the War Machine factions. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You asked if it's a side grade, downgrade, upgrade. I would just say it's just something a little bit different. If you decided you wanted to be a pure Infernalist, nothing wrong with that. I reckon you can get by with those three casters for sure.
Cool.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's more, personally speaking, it's more on the like wacky side of things, and it thus complicates matchups. The simple fact is, as you just basically alluded to very well, James, the Infernal Masters as a trifecta cover pretty much everything already. So if you're taking Hearts of Darkness, you're sort of messing things up, possibly in a good way, possibly in a bad way, but depends on what you've... If you're taking Hearts of Darkness, unless you're taking it basically for meme reasons, like to put some kind of cross themes and do other kinds of nonsense, if you're doing it in a competitive standpoint, it's generally speaking for a very specific purpose. I would say, like, the one that is talked about the most... that just like used as like a boogeyman is usually Kara Sloane, and that's because Kara Sloane in Infernals, one, the theme benefit of Hearts of Darkness is just so absolutely crazy with her. The fact is that you can use soulless models to give focus to your warjacks for just showing up, which means Kara Sloane very predictably sold her soul to get charges with two focus without having to allocate to them. Fucking just like, can I sell my soul again? Can I get three focus somehow? Let's do this.
Right. Also, Orin is insane for her.
Yeah.
Orin Auron, specifically Auron 2, right? Like, just this, then this point you're like, I think if you are playing Hearts of Darkness, my personal preference is, as you said, Zadaroth covers pretty much everything, so you can just have, like, Zadaroth, and then pair it with some horrifying skew of some kind of description. Again, like, Kara Sloan immediately comes to mind, but, like, double Howlers plus Adjudicator is pretty good as, like, pairing for that. Like,
yeah.
You go for something like that.
The key, one of the really key selling points of Hearts of Darkness is that the units that exist in Infernals, i.e. Howlers, Grievers, even Crows, if you want to play them in a Infernal Master list, you are, because the faction revolves so closely around summoning, there are limited opportunities to explore things like buffs on Howlers. However, these other casters who do not depend on summoning, like Sloan, like Fiora, they can make much better synergy with Howlers than the typical Infernal Masters. I'm yet to see it really well explored with Grievers. However, and Chris, I know you've got experience sort of in the dojo with Malakov as well. You can really come at it from a different angle, and there are some really bizarre combos. So again, for example, in Fiora 3, I'm running Regna because she's a great little package. However, you don't have Cultists in this list. So what she ends up doing is what you would never do in Dark Legacy. You're actually sacrificing Choir of Menoth to refill her. And then you are sometimes even allocating to your Horrors, which is a negative EV move in a Dark Legacy list. But however, it's perfectly fine in Hearts of Darkness. So lots of crazy room to explore if you're, I would say, an experienced player.
Yes, definitely.
You could even sacrifice if you wanted.
I mean, look, like all good factions, like, say, Krix, Infernals have some of the best ways to concede the game. If you want to just literally off, like, you can concede the game in some spectacular ways. Just like how you can sack pawn, like, you know, like, ritual sacrifice Scar in order to say, well, fuck it, I'm out. You could have Princess Granovi execute a sudden but inevitable betrayal and, like, eat your Infernal Master for focus. The possibilities are endless. I would say, like, regarding, just quickly regarding Malakov, the typical one there is, like, this is a strength of basically Hearts of Darkness, is you can cross themes and internal boundaries. So the one I saw, and actually Brian ran this a fair bit, was Demo Core with Howlers with Sorcerer's Zero. So Sorcerer's Zero gives them boundless charge. I think actually one of the ones that, personally speaking, I think is probably underplayed is actually probably Gaston. First of all, Gaston, too, is super fun. He's a cool guy, and he just does some fucking crazy shit. And he has probably the best buff I can think of out of this list of casters for Howlers, which is Dauntless Resolve, because frankly, +3 armor on a unit with that kind of stat, it's just really good.
So now furthermore, like, with Regna, you're running armor 22 Howlers, which you wouldn't see in Dark Legacy. It's that kind of stuff that's really cute.
And then, like, again, like, you could bring some stuff like Gaston's gun is, like, basically the main. Soul Reaver is one of the best characters in the game. It's such a fucking cool gun.
Want to love Gaston, but he comes into the same problem right now as the Soul Snake, where a lot of matchups are really bad.
I love the idea
of having a Super Saiyan Warcaster, but it's really hard to make work right now.
Yeah, but nobody shoots like Gaston.
It's true.
Nobody collects
Gaston. No one boosts like Gaston.
No one lifeguards like Gaston. Good times. No one fire groups really like Gaston.
He's got a lot of really cool options. It's just a shame that two things. Number one, the meta craps on him because Archons say no to souls, and there's a shitload of shield guards out there. So maybe his time will come.
Yeah, it's fine. The thing is, like, you can still make a Gaston list, and you're like, oh, this is going to be fucking amazing. This is going to be fun as shit. Let's do this. I get the entire Merc stable. Let's go.
Yeah.
All right. Which
is so a really long list of models, by the way.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tom. Was that Tom?
The Merc staples. Like, I was, like, scrolling through War Room to, like, read up, make a Gaston list for just for like research, and there's like the amount of things you have to like look through is like insane. There's so many, very big range.
Yep.
Also, trying to build a Hearts of Darkness list in War Room is an absolute nightmare because you have to scroll through all of Sigmar and Menoth and Kaedor and blah 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 blah. So yes, that's actually terrible. Don't do that. use conflict chamber.
Yeah.
Until you figure out what you're running. And just finally on Hearts of Darkness, you guys tell me about Sloane in Hearts of Darkness, because to me all it says is negative play experience.
That's pretty much it. Exactly. Like, what do you want, right? Like, the whole thing is you just say, like, what the real strength of Sloane is that there are a lot of, and it's something I want to get into next, is, like, the weaknesses and problems of Infernals and problem matchups. Sloane pairs quite nicely with a lot of them because, one, what she's bringing is completely different to what Infernals are doing. Like, Infernals have got, like, crab hands, crabbing up the board and, like, summoning more crabs and just generally shitting on the board and drowning you in stuff, whereas Sloane does her Sloane things, again, like hyper-efficiency. The problem is it's as good as Sloane gets,
because you get to get the two Shadowfire guys. You get, like, basically full focus on all your jacks, and you get rerolls on the turns you really need it. Like, this is as good as Sloane gets.
Correct. Yeah. And it's also... Sorry, go on.
It's just a list that asks a crazy hard question.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's basically like, everyone else is playing, like, basically War Machine, and you're like, cool, here's my 40k list. It's a Tau list. It's got guns and guns. There's literally no fucking... There's no subtlety there. Its only job is to blow you off the table.
So, come at hypothetical me. For you then. Why do you think they chose Sloane as the HOD caster?
Because I don't think they thought about it that much.
Yeah. I hate this. It's also kind of hard. Like, Kane would make more thematic sense, but then we'd have a conversation of, like, how could you possibly allow Kane to be in this theme? I think personally,
I thought they picked it based on like the fluff they wrote beforehand.
Yeah, but like none of the fluff makes sense for any of the Sigmar casters really to be in like Infernals. But here we go, Sloane it is.
Sure, no, Striker makes sense. Like you can, the fluff reasoning is like is pretty weak because you can pretty much write anything in this story at this point and it makes sense.
Striker actually kind of does make sense given his old arc. Yeah, that's fair.
Except that he's, like, now in charge of Morrow and is an arc on in the fluff. Like,
yeah, but, I mean, he did also, like, you know, basically do some sketchy shit in previous edition. It's cool. Yeah, it's fine.
Again, it's an alternate history. Could have happened at any point when he switched sides.
Yeah.
It's theoretical.
Oh, yeah. Or the other answer, to sell chargers for... To pick whichever lane you want to believe in.
Like, I mean, feel like it's not fair to say that they just, like, picked out of a hat and that they didn't test it enough. But the way it came out of CID and the way we saw it, it was like, we went from everything to, like, this incredibly small selection that we didn't get to test all that much. And then when you look at the choices they made, they weren't exactly inspiring. You can do some cool stuff with some of them.
You get to play Vlad or Hayleth.
Can we have a moment of silence, please?
There that I'd like to see fixed, just in terms of like, why do Menoth get four Fioras and Kaedor get Malakov and Sigmar gets Sloane when they're all so different? I appreciate what Infernals do for the fluff, and I think it's actually a really exciting time for them, especially with the whole Henchhold scrolls. But, gameplay-wise, Sloane makes
sure also, just stop whatever is into factions. There's already four. Nobody plays in any of them.
I think they could have spent more time on selecting these casters with the community, because I think we could have come up with some interesting stuff, and then we would have avoided the Kaer Sloanes, and we would have avoided the Morten Ebras, honestly. Like,
I think... bigger thing here is, and this is probably where they fucked up, is what they probably should have done is when they CID'd Infernals in the first place, like back in then, they should have actually had an epic version of a caster from a main faction go Infernal, right? And specifically be in this Hearts of Darkness. And then you can justify any of them going in. Like you could have Kara 2, Electric Boogaloo. She's now an Infernalist, right? For various reasons. Well, that would mean you could. that would way easier justify any such inclusion, and then you'd actually have this fearless stopgap. Incidentally, moment of silence, please, for the amazingness that was Vlad with Howler, Vlad 2 with Howlers, Sylvestro with Howlers, Haley 3 with Howlers. Oh, man, the list was endless. It was anyone who never...
I like how they most... tried to fix Lucas.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, that didn't work.
I mean, I've seen Infernal Lucas lists running around. They're basically Crucible Guard lists, but better because...
Lucas lists, right?
They're better Lucas lists, right? Because, like, they acknowledge that, just like Kara Sloan, it's just like, okay, look, the name of the game is face, face, face. We're just going to kill you. Lucas is doing as much drugs as is humanly possible. He's going to have 9 juice tokens by turn 3, and hopefully you're dead. And in order to make sure this happens, Oren has a giant stack of cultists, and they're all going to commit Sudoku. And there's going to be rerolls everywhere. It'll be great.
Yeah, there's no about, like, Lucas. Like, when you play Crucible Guard, it's like, well, he might not die by turn 4. Like, he is dead by the end of turn 3, regardless of if there's an opponent on the other side of the table.
Yeah. And then in this case, it's just like, okay, maybe we can do... Maybe we're just, like, just screw subtly. We're just going ham as it is. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so... Go on, Tom. You're the man with the mission.
Yep, I'm gonna... look at the list. So, what are you guys finding Infernals are particularly strong to? Or, like, is there a matchup where they're just very hard winning at the moment and that's making them relevant? Or are they sort of just good into the field? I know we talked about Zadaroth before, but, like, you know, just in broad general terms, where are we sort of seeing them sit at the moment success-wise?
To quote us from last cast, where we were talking about this thing, Infernals is 100% a sub-faction you cannot half-ass against. If you do so, you just get owned. That's all there is to it. If you make if you are considering Infernals, you have to consider the matchup. Because if you bumble into it, you're just going to get shut down by so many means. And it comes down to, first of all, how Infernals work as a faction. They are very much like... The list building is only really half of the game, like, in terms of army construction. The other half is what you do on the table. Like, what order do you sacrifice your solos? Who do you sacrifice, and what you've brought for specific matchups? So, let's just say you just bumble into Infernals. Well, cool, they're just going to go like, okay, well, I'm just going to sacrifice in the optimal order, and I'm going to tailor pick my heavies that I'm summoning and getting in, just to, like, completely put the boot in, so you can fucking enjoy that. Infernals, to me, probably have the strongest heavy game, generally speaking. Like, if you're looking at, like, the heavy off kind of armies...
Even stronger than Karchev, Chris?
Probably, yes. It's stronger in different ways, because it's more flexible, right? Like, that's the thing. Like,
Karchev,
like, it's a runaway freight train made of cancer, right? Like, I can't say it's, like... It's definitely the most flexible.
Oh, my God.
Runaway
freight train. Wonderful visuals, Chris. Wonderful visuals.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
Like, possibly Grimkin is stronger, right? Possibly Karchev's stronger... But none of them are going to be as flexible because none of them can literally retailer their list halfway through the game and go like, you know what? I think I really need a lot of Desolators because you just got this fucking shit ton of armor. Or like, hey, you forgot your Archons. It's Soul Snake time.
Yeah.
In addition, as you said, like, Zadaroth, by her existence, covers so much of the field and she pairs extremely nicely, especially with Omidamus, I find. Because sometimes... Omidamus, just real quick on him, he brings basically, like... he's the only guy with synergy who can make more models, right? No other synergy caster can, like, just act like you can't play Virus 2, right? And then summon a bunch of extra griffins. But Omidamus obviously can. It's literally part of his job. And he does it so easily. And this gives him a really important thing. He can get around one of the primary weaknesses, if you can really call it a weakness, of synergy. You know, when you use synergy, you got to commit models and make attacks and. That means you have to trade models. Well, when you're trading free crabs for, like, getting your +3, it doesn't really matter anymore, does it? Especially, and you can go even further, you can use, like, Lamenters and stuff to get 2 for the price of 1. So, yeah, well, this will...
No, go ahead.
No, go for it. I've talked certainly enough.
Whoa.
That's a first.
What, the four horsemen of the apocalypse? Jesus Christ.
We are talking about Infernals, the end of War Machine as we know it.
As we know it.
Yes.
I find that mostly worry about Akadon, because it's like a giant pain to think about how far you have to stay away before you like die to like Hellmouth randomly triggering like Revelation, the other darkness, and then he like teleports forward, flips you, and then just like,
yeah,
there's just a lot of
I've been doing a lot of thinking about Agathon, and I definitely agree. I think incredibly high skill ceiling, because she has three vectors, right? Number one is her personal assassination, which is just ballistic from
space. They, James, they.
Sorry, yes, they. Secondly, her they. they're melee. They can send a tormentor 20 inches or a snake 22 inches, so that can just randomly kill you with double hellmouth shenanigans. And then finally, their personal ability to needle you and throw you back into her army for horrors to eat you up. So just, and they're all crazy non-linear vectors with rerolls and insurance everywhere, and it's just craziness. So
they're the Infernal Master I've spent the least amount of time with, mostly because when I was picking them up, it was practicing for CanCon and deciding, like, what do I have time to actually learn? And I played a couple games with them, and they are incredibly interesting. But, man, like you said, they have a high ceiling. And I feel like they're the easiest to mess up with because they're not straightforward at all compared to the other two. Like, you have Zadaroth, who's toolboxy, has a lot of interesting rules they can bring to the table. And Omo is pretty much just a brick to the face, depending on how you want to play him. And you can play him as brick to the face as you want. And just thinking about Agathon has been interesting. My only problem is every time I try and bring them anywhere, all those stupid little, like, cloths or talismans or whatever hanging off of them is keep falling off. Like, those do not fucking stay on the model.
Look, as someone who played a lot of Cassius in Mark 2, where he was the only guy who could double Hellmouth, in a faction like Circle with crazy movement shenanigans, just any caster who can double Hellmouth is straight away just going to be absolutely nuts in some sort of good player's hands. So,
funnily enough, that was exactly what I was going to say. It's like playing against Agathon reminded me a lot about playing against you back in the day, James. That fucking stupid Cassius shit. I teleport, teleport, Hellmouth, Hellmouth. Oh, look, there's a Stalker there. Where'd the Stalker come from? It's like, I brought it from my sideboard. It was hiding in my dead pile. It was actually alive. And now here it is, in your face.
Oh, man. Speaking of Wormwood, remember, James, when we were, like, Super Series, and we made the best Wormwood list that was illegal at the beginning because you couldn't take non-black
craft. Can I just say, that guy would go from, like, 9 out of 10 to outstanding because... in Secret Masters, because he loves minions, but he can't play in that theme. Anyway, off topic. Yeah. Tom, you're on fire with the questions. Have you played into Infernals much?
I have, actually. I played into one of our locals quite a lot, against Frawley quite a bit when he was sort of testing out the waters. And I have got a few tournament games against them. I played against Pete at CanCon, and... just a little brag, I beat him quite handily, and I felt really good about that, because you don't get to do that very often.
Lovely.
But I've actually found playing against them, like, it's really interesting. They're not easy to play against, but they're as I've become more confident with the game, I've actually really liked them as a faction to enter, because they're really engaging to play against the entire time, and you, like, they're not a safe faction to play against. Like, you always feel like you can lose. But they don't necessarily feel tilting in terms of, like, you know, nothing's ever statted, nothing's exceptionally difficult to remove a lot of the time. And that means that you kind of are engaging in my favorite type of war machine, which is, like, puzzle, not untying. And I think that's sort of, like, a fundamental skill that you need to have playing against them, because they feel really strong if they get to just keep that knot really tight, and if you have the ability to sort of start dismantling that in ways that can throw them off, and sort of and they're a faction where, you know, quick opportunistic plays that, like, sort of take a little bit more than is expected or anything like that, really can swing the game, and that makes it, like, for me, really, really fun, because then you start engaging in a bit of a Mexican standoff, and against a list that has lots of really interesting moving components. So like I really like playing against them, and I think they're really cool, and I think they're really, really powerful, and I think that that's sort of like a cool place for them to sit at the moment.
As someone across the table from them, do you feel, and they're summoning a heavy in every turn, two questions. Number one, does that feel unfair? Does it feel bad? Like, what's the emotional reaction? And number two, do you know why Pete was going to be captain of one of the Australian WTC teams this year, good player, won the Super Series last year. Do you know why Pete was a bit sort of ambivalent on them or not convinced?
That's an interesting question.
I'll answer the second question, so you go on, sure. Tom, for the first one.
Okay. First question being
emotional reaction to
something. Yeah, I think like if you can mentally prepare, I actually find mentally preparing for summoning a lot easier than say mentally preparing for Arcana, because it's a pretty known quantity at a known pace. I think that if you can sort of factor into your game plan that you're playing in something that like an exponential growth engine. But it is a delayed growth engine, then you can really sort of mitigate a lot of that capitalizing that the Infernal player can do on pace and sort of bulk. So from the get-go, if you're prepared to maybe throw a few early trades out that aren't going to cost you hugely, just like sort of, you know, taking out Solas is so huge. Bringing in control elements that sort of prevent them from being, like even when they do start hitting critical mass, that they're really sort of... slowed and delayed in their ability to deliver and sort of keep momentum pushing through is hugely powerful in sort of avoiding like that tilt at the idea that your like opponent is basically getting money for free and you are absolutely not. And that's kind of one of the big things that you need to sort of come to terms with when playing against Infernals, because otherwise, like if you sort of have the plan of like, you know, I'm going to build up my Kamehameha and when I'm ready, we're going to fight, then you're in for a bad time because they're not going to really care that you've built up this really big power move, because fundamentally, like the thing that makes the crab hands that I found really, really important and really impressive is that it's just redundancy in numbers. Like it's a simple number. It's a power 17 base, whatever it is, mat 7, and you just have that multiple times over. So it doesn't really matter if you've taken it out, like out 1, 2, or 3 heavies, because usually they've got enough to keep fighting through. So you start picking your fights based on making sure that you're factoring scenario play and all that sort of stuff, and sort of forcing errors on their end. So it's not fun to have your opponent like, you know, 20, 30 points up on you in a game before the fight even starts. But it's all part of factoring into how to play against them and how to sort of make that process of them getting up quite difficult or non-optimized as they go. Speaking about the game with Pete, like, and Pete's like an absolute legend and amazing player. But in that game, I think that those things caught up with him. And I think that like the cast that I brought, that I played against him with, which is Kruger 2, is sort of like a perfect example of a cast that sort of enables elements to mess with what Infernals do quite hard, where, you know, turning things around and like slowing down and having your own threat extenders and things like that and bringing your own personal threat sort of counteracts those elements. And I think that after watching him, and Chris, you probably want to jump in here where we start talking about Pete's ambivalence to the faction, but I think that he sort of felt like games can just get away from you very quickly.
It goes both ways.
The rubber banding for Infernals feels quite off kilter. Like they're not a faction designed to be forgiving once you've had sort of a calamitous blow, and the recovery mechanic isn't huge. I'd say Agathon is a big exception to that because. You've got the Rube Goldberg in the back pocket all the time. But I think that was sort of where he was sitting after that.
Yeah.
Brian. Experience, just, and again, it's limited, but I've always felt like if you were looking at the game on like a balance, a lot of things sit in the middle where it's usually a close game in between, where a lot of Infernal games I find usually swing really hard one way or the other. It's either like you lose too many models early, it's hard for you to summon the things you need to make up for the numbers you require, and you just get trounced really early in the game and have a hard time climbing back, and it's a real struggle. So it's really early the game goes bad for you. Or the other way goes, and like games against like Colin are an example of this, is just like you start the machine and it works exactly as it's intended, and just slowly the scale goes entirely the other way, and it just feels you steamroll the opponent, and it feels really good. But for, I'll say for Colin, who's not here to defend himself, like it was not, he didn't feel like it was like the best experience, where you just seem like no matter what you do, no matter what choice you make, the opponent just kind of just rolls right over.
That's kind of a Colin like, special against you, though, during CanCon.
Hmm?
That's kind of a Colin special he plays against you during CanCons. Like,
No, yes, this is the second time in the first round I have played against him and went poorly for him. But the first time it was honestly because he made a poor mistake, forgot about Ambush, and that pretty much allowed me to take two very important models off the table very early. This time it was purely ambush him with heavies.
You ambushed him with a faction he couldn't really answer, and then he just like went, well, fuck it.
No, we talked about the game. If he had not lost the, I misunderstood you there. Yes, first game was a mistake he made in play that we talked about later, that he could have easily played very well. It would have been an interesting game had he not lost models early. Versus, like, in a really silly way, versus losing to a faction that he just didn't seem to feel like he had any answers for in terms of the way they played and what they could do.
So this is where I think I should jump in. So, you know, the thing with Infernals to keep in mind is, I mean, read it online, Infernals are literally the end of War Machine. They've killed competitive play. There's no point showing up. Just like, as soon as you see Zadaroth, just immediately shake your opponent's hand. You're done. Go home. Get fucked. Cry in a bucket. It's fine. It's fine. The game will be fine. COVID. Clearly Infernals behind that COVID-19. Anyway, it is actually
keeping it classy.
As always. Anyway, Infernals, you have to just get over it, right? Like, look, they summon heavies, it's bullshit, whatever, okay? As I said, if you come in to the game...
Infernals, get over it.
Get over it. There you go, podcast title right there. It's easy. It comes out naturally. But no, seriously, like, it is just something, like, Infernals are very much a faction of just, like, if you are not ready for them, you get Colin's experience, where you basically show up, you're like... You look at both your lists, you're like, I can't deal with any of this, and then all I'm going to do is just get fucking trounced and steamrolled, and I can't even assassinate them because they've got anti-assassination mechanics built in that are just really quite good for their use, right? Like, well, fuck, what do I do? And then you've basically, the answer apparently is you go into War Machine General and you post the thing about how busted Infernals are. So, why then did Peter Bates and... Why, honestly, do a bunch of us just not have that high an opinion of Infernals? And I think it honestly comes down to what happens when you do have a game where your opponent is ready for you, and you also do just, like, have to deal with just a close game and the attrition swings. Personally speaking, the things we found that we disliked about Infernals very much. Number one, they have an absolute horrid time on any scenario where flags are important. Bunkers was by far the easiest counter at all to Infernals. Just play on bunkers, most lists can probably beat them if they've got enough solos. And that's just because the fact is, they are using their solos to turn into heavies. When you make an Infernal list, I think one of the models you probably want to definitely keep on the table is Nissia. Like, keep her in your list, even if she's the first one to go. Because you will come into those scenarios where you need Nissia to be a flag bitch, and you'll need that kind of model that can run 7, shoot someone, run and gun, and run to the other flag to stay in the zone, to stay alive and kicking, because you can't otherwise participate in the scenario game. In fact, you are actively killing yourself as you go through the game doing so, and this is where you start having to think about stuff like, do I summon past turn 3? I will run out of solos if I keep doing this. Do I have my caster YOLO swaggins at upper board in order to, like, get on the flags. That makes sense with Omidemus, for instance, quite a lot. But you're like, do I really want, like, Zadaroth there? I don't really think so. Personally speaking, like, what we found with, like, Batesy, between Batesy and myself, is just that aspect is really difficult, especially because a lot of the Infernalists do look alike and the differences do come down to casters. That will mean that if your opponent is good into Infernals, they will be good into all facets of Infernal Master Infernals. So, an example of one which I got into an internet talk about, like, the other day was, like, Wolves of Winter in Kador, specifically with Vlad 2. It's one of the best counters to Infernals in the game, because you just you've got an answer for almost anything they do. Even their Desolator Clouds, you can just blow them away with Vlad, you out-threat them, you out-damage them. You can take a Victor if you really want to nail the thing in the coffin. The Victor will single-handedly bring their solo game coming crashing down. One thing we haven't talked about as well that's important is Cultists. Cultists, I think, are where Infernals are actually balanced, because while their heavies are cheap and their solos are great, Cultists are a lead ball and chain keeping you down.
Actually, just to throw that to guys that are actually playing Infernals at the moment and in like the current meta, are you feeling like Cultists are a detriment to your lists?
They're not a detriment, but like when we talk about tax. Stop saying that word. Okay. When you talk about summoning a heavy, honestly, what you're doing is you're paying the cost of the 3 to 4 essence, the solo you need to sacrifice. But to get that essence, generally that also costs you one of your cultists in the back, which are also one of the models that provide essence for the models on the table. Absolutely. So you're actually losing, like, it feels like as the game goes on, it's exponentially more expensive to actually keep your summoning heavies on the table. So even though it looks cheap to the person across the table, you as the player, as the game continues on, it feels like unless you're in a really strong position, it's getting more and more expensive for you to actually play the game you want, because you're constantly losing more. And those cultists, as you slowly lose them off the table to attrition and to you having to fuel Regna and your caster, means that you're slowly losing options for what you're able to actually do, which is why like Hermit's so important to the list. But if he's usually front and center to be as useful as he wants to, and there are people who can just take him off the table, and then your cultists really have to carry the load of your entire army. And if you're sacrificing them every turn for one or two models, you're usually losing about 3 on average every 2 turns. It's pretty bad.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely nailed it, dude.
Important part of playing Infernals, actually, is recognizing when you can get away with just cutting to refuel as opposed to sacrificing cultists, especially with Gravnoy. Yes, I finally got a name right. She can frequently summon like a Shrieker, and then, especially if there's a gate around, she can just refuel the focus herself unless she's cast D-Cell. She can just cut to like refill any missing focus, and that might be fine, especially if you have stuff like a healing objective in there. And with Infernal Masters, this might be more necessary if you see it as a thing in the long run. Probably not the best with Agathon, but even then, like, there are turns when Agathon's going to camp and not have to spend it all down, and then you'd be like, well, I'd rather take 6 damage than lose a cultist, because that cultist is like 2 essence every turn over the course of the game.
They're also one of the usually the only thing you bring in your list that can score a circle zone.
Yes.
Like, they're that important to your list sometimes. That's why it's really hard sometimes to play the scenario game, because you're constantly killing 2 of the things you actually require to score you things. You're losing solos every turn, and you're losing your units piece by piece. And if you need them to score a zone, they're even more dangerous, because the models are like 12-12, which means they die to a stiff breeze.
Yeah, you absolutely nailed it, Brian. And then on top of that, add in the fact that we're talking about towing this balance where you are in control. If your opponent manages to snipe out 1, 2, 3 cultists, or, you know, you can't use them because the book's there, or they're under bestial or whatever, they're made redundant for whatever reason, it really compounds, and therefore you start paying, I'll use the word, tax as the game progresses.
What happened to Tom?
He got disconnected. I'm re-adding the call. Keep going, please.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you're in control of it, even then it's a delicate balancing act. Randomly losing 2, 3, 4 cultists can really throw a wrench in your plans, to the point where you might actually consider not summoning heavies, because there's no point if you can't feel them, right? They just die.
But that's so real detrimental to the game plan of an Infernal. And that's why I just said, like, it can really easily snowball in either direction for an Infernal player. Like, it can go your way real hard, or it can go against you real fast if the opponents get a lucky deviation, have really useful ambush models, or just are able to take the right pieces off at the right time.
Absolutely.
Return of the Redeemer spin.
Long range guns do have a very important place in the Infernals.
Well, it's... as you said, the Victor is disgusting because it doesn't even really protect you from with a shield guard.
The most hilarious thing about the Victor is when you've got, like, a fucking Umbral Guardian shows up to protect it, and you just kill the model you originally shot in the first place anyway with, like, a boosted blast damage or a continuous fire, and you're like, that was real great. Thanks.
Well, if you clip a horde, you can also take away their Pathfinder in some lists.
Yeah.
Well, that's real bad.
Yeah. And, like, a Victor is actually... if it wasn't for that gun, like, a Victor would be just not the model you want against, like, Infernals. You don't want to trade a Colossal for a zero-point heavy, quote-unquote zero-point heavy, right? But when you go into that, it's just really hard to, match and, like, play against. So that's sort of, like, one of the weaknesses there. I think we could go into how, roughly speaking, we find various factions deal with Infernals and see what common trends are there. Or don't worry about that. Don't want to talk about how, like, say, Signar or, like, fuck, what are you even playing today, Tom?
Convergence.
Does Convergence deal with, like, Infernals? Because, again, it's something you do...
Akathon is a big problem. That's what I heard. Like, speaking from, like, people playing, Strange Bedfellows. Like, it is a really big problem when all your, like, models are, like, angels. Like,
Hellmouth Potter, right, yes.
Just sweep it all up, and then...
Yeah, but you can also play, like, you know, Clockwork Legion, and Eradicators are very good. Eradicators are actually extremely good into heavies, generally.
Yeah, speaking. But on the snowball part, that's why I like bringing up, like, caster like Agathon and Sloan. Like, in general, in my mind, the Infernals are, like, an attrition, mostly faction, just based on how their mechanics are designed, and then, like, how their resources work. That's why I really like casters with, like, a back pocket answer for a win. Like, when things, like, start spiraling the other way. Like when you play Agathon or Sloan, right, you always know, like, there at some point, there's at least a 40% shot open. Like, just with, like, Agathon's feet spent, just throwing dark fires out, or just Sloan being Sloan. Like,
100%. It's one of the reasons I liked playing Zoltu, is because in the back pocket, if the game ever turned away from him in terms of attrition, he usually ended up just fueling up his assassination run.
Yeah, like, when I watched Infernal's game play out, like, last year, War Machine Weekend, CanCon, and then just playing against it in Super Series and then at CanCon, just, like, when you start attritioning Snowball, like, on, like, that or other Omo, there's really hard for them to effectively swing back into the game. Like, when I was playing Dagrush 1 against Zadaroth, like, it just felt like there was a 0% chance I could lose when I was up two heavies with Dag 1. Like Infernals, like, they're set up to be... They start up on attrition normally against most factions just because, like it's really hard to get a hold of them before, like, turn 2, and normally if they go first with the plus 1 from that guy that gives plus 1, like, you're likely to be up, like, around 1.5-ish heavy on them, depends on what's going on, right? So, like, but some lists are just designed to be, to overcome those, like, differences. Like, when you play against, like, Kriaz 3, when you play against Vladimir Reavers, when you play against Child, it's, like, with like, Skinemon's base list instead of, like, Cloxus. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, when I played against, Zadaroth with Child, like, it didn't matter how many, like, 11-19 crabs he made that game. Like, a PAL 23 Skinemon as well as butter knife all of them. Like,
yeah, but that's also because you got into a situation where you dictated the flow of the game, right?
So yeah. They have pretty static threats in that range, and that you have abuse and one other way to extend it, right?
Tantrum.
Yeah. So it's 12 and maybe 14, whereas he can start. I mean, Amadeus isn't great there, but the other two can really get around those threat ranges. So it might be an effect to the higher skill cap casters, but
it's probably an effect of more of like a meta shift because of like Infernos like exists now, so you can't play those like lists that normally attritions well into lists like those, but so you have to like escalate like as they do. So maybe we'll see what the Infernos list becomes now that like as we saw in CanCon, right? People just routinely kill 4-5 crabs on the turn. Like I heard that story a lot during that weekend. So maybe we'll see something different.
Yeah. Hey, have we got Tom?
Yeah, mate. I just dropped you out for a second.
Yep. I got him back.
Cool. On the peripheral mentioned a couple of particular lists, but what are you guys noticing is like list wise is very strong into Infernals. Like, are we looking at lists that are playing really hard on scenario, very hard on like attrition, or a combination of the two? Like, are there thresholds that they just struggle to handle? What have been your experiences?
Yeah, so the first thing is any list that's strong on scenario is, and also attritions well, like it doesn't have to be well, like super well, but as long as it's well enough, will have an advantage against Infernals. If they can do both, then even fucking better. And the reason why is, as we said, like Infernals, you're actively killing your own scoring pieces. So when you have like, say, like, I don't know, Kreos 3 with his like faithful masses brick of shit coming in to town, right? And they're pushing you on scenario and killing crabs, and you're feeling like you as the Infernals player have to like start laying high to go in order to try and kill Crusaders in order to claw your way back into the game. Those are the kind of lists that are strong into Infernals. It's either, as James said just then, Infernals have pretty long threat ranges, generally speaking, apart from Omodamus, right? So either you have even longer threat ranges, or if you yourself have a means of blunting an assault of crabs. One other thing Infernals actually have a big problem with is that their mat scores do not, like, they don't really have great ways to increase their mat. So
you're joking. Oh my
god. Are you kidding?
What are you talking about, Chris?
They got Runewood.
So busted, dude.
Yeah. But Runewood is
a roll to hit.
So okay, then ask me this, James. How would you use Runewood against a fucking Menoth list? Against some kind of Menoth Harby list, right? It's just like, what, you're going to pick a initiate unit to go tell them to get +2 to hit, and you still might not hit anyway, and then whums if there's a bunch of the units mixed in. That's your problem, is you don't have, like, you got it good against one target, right? But across the board, not great.
Yeah, I find that that's all you really need. So if you look at Amadeus, you can start your synergy chain at map 9. Pretty good.
Yeah.
And there aren't
that actually is
that you need to hit.
Yeah.
On top of that,
that's one of the reasons Omodamus makes it, by the way.
Yeah, that is actually one of the reasons.
I mean, it's also why Orin's
Menoth drop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, James, but I was going to say, it's also feels like why Orin is actually quite good in that faction is if you're not actively fixing the number, you can fix the dice.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, absolutely. So Orin's a huge play there. Also, I was doing the math on the Zadaroth assassination. She can quite easily. You can apply +2 with Runewood, +2 with a functionally black spot, and +4 if you fish for a rerollable boosted crit on Stygian Abyss. So I generally would find that I don't think it's as big a problem as you make it out to be. And then even then, clusters like Agathon are just inherently accurate in their lists that they bring. So can't say I agree there.
That's fine. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, get fucked.
Yeah, fine. All right, I'll tell Tamar you just shat on what he was saying then. But also, I mean, you said excellent. Two very different things there. You're not saying, like, yeah, sure. Like, if you fucking got all that shit onto Harby, and then, yeah, congratulations, Harby's fucking dead. Okay, I got no comeback from there. But you got to get to her first. And again, this is the part where, like, Wums, if they start pushing the thing away from you, so... But regardless,
absolutely.
Exactly, like, okay, look, if you knock a caster down, and Infernals have a lot of miniatures that can knock down models with headbutts and throws, then you auto-hit, therefore they've got no defense, it's fine, it's fine. It's fine. Everything's fine. Anyway, yeah, to play into Infernals, the lists that are looking are basically scenario lists that are either... that basically have enough weight of power to get through their heavies one way or another. Casters with good personal output are always important. Like, they're just really good into Infernals in general, but you do have to be careful that you yourself don't die. Like, Butcher is, for instance, a great caster into Infernals. Just try not to die to, like, some fucking, like, Agathon teleporting you up because you killed a cultist somehow, and then, like, crowd surfing you into, like, basically... three tormentors. Butcher is decently tanky, but he's not that tanky. Similar deal with, say, what else is also good into Infernals, come to think of it? Yeah, any just spell denial.
Just Chromac yes. one. It's fun.
Chromac one. A Chromac one is if you ever have an Infernal problem, just play Chromac one. It's like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, Bestial on Cultist makes him really sad. Same with the book from Menoth. Yeah, you need to, like, there's two ways of doing it. Number one, you alpha them and make sure that you go all in on your Bestial plus, what's that thing that he has? Spiny Growth plus a Tharn Shaman. If you summon one from the well, you've then got a 15-19 no knockdown caster who can pretty much stand there and say, you got one turn to counter until all your horrors die. Or you can absorb the alpha and Bestial just poos on them. So, yeah, two ways of doing it, really.
Throw him back.
Yeah, he's my boy. My boy.
You know what's even more gross is Chromac also shuts down Hermit, so you're just like, cool, that's even better. Fuck, man. I played Zadaroth into Zakova, and extremely similar situation happened, but I was able to hold on for the one turn where everything shut down, but it was horrendous.
I could say, as an Infernal player, I would be mortified if somebody came in with one of two things outside of, you know, these blanket solutions. Number one, really good spot removal. Number two, long range, like, not even joking, like Redeemers or like snipe units or anything with like 20 plus range that is wiping out my cultists over one or two turns.
Oh yeah. My god, it's PK's turn to shine.
I was say, if we go through casters, then somehow if we go through factions, the first faction would be Signo with like Hearts of Darkness, also PK'ing somehow. Play PKing into.
And again, that's an interesting conundrum where, like, if the Infernal player is trying to be a bit cute and get one step ahead and they brought a Hearts of Darkness list, like, now your Infernal answer isn't great. So,
well, that's exactly why. That's exactly why, like, it's perfect. Like, that's exactly why casters like Sloan or Lucas or these kind of things show up in these lists and why they're perfect. Like, so. If you have, like, say, Weapon Master Span, yeah, you can win. You can force them to not play their optimal counter to you on because your, like, thing just shits on their counter, even though they know that you're probably never going to play Sloan. You might do a jack where you don't even take the models out. And then you later tell your opponent you didn't even bring the models. You just wrote that, like, list on your sheet of paper, right?
That would be a test, actually, if you had enough time just to go to a tournament, like, let's say a big con and play your two Dark Legacies. Go to the exact same con in the exact same universe and play one Dark Legacy, one Sloan, and just see, just compare and contrast, because I think the results would be horrifying. Wow,
yeah, that's exactly.
A clickbait title to an article.
Yeah.
You'll never believe the results.
Matchup number 5 will really surprise you. Yeah, it's easy example there is like, so Flame in the Darkness is, as somewhat unsurprisingly, is also pretty good into Infernals, right? Like, all of those guys hit ridiculously hard. Flame in the Darkness into fucking Kara Sloan. I'm not excited. I mean, I know Flame in the Darkness is not a list that, like, takes kindly to being shot at, but Kara isn't really shooting you so much as she's just, like, gunning you down in mass. And then that's to say you don't get, like, fucking, like, Striker 3 just accidentally killed or Striker 2 killed or any of that shit happening. So I mean, you've got to really work from it.
Definitely going to die. He's, like, the only large base in the army.
Yeah. That's not true. You got the Archons, but that's the thing. Is like, are you hiding Striker then behind, like, three Archons just hoping for the best with behind your Hermit role? And then he's like, cool, I guess I'll just kill your entire army then. Like, that's fun.
Yeah, do not recommend.
But hey, regardless, like, you can half-ass the Hearts of Darkness matchups, though, but the actual main deck Dark Legacy Infernals, you have to really think about what you're doing. And ideally, try and make a pair that works, like, so both lists can play into it. And if you're actually in Shit Creek and you're, like, have to play into the Dark Legacy matchup with something, look, go for the throat right away. Either go for a big scenario blitz or go for the assassination. Take it, because if you can fool them into playing attrition long enough that you get a good shot for their caster, it's probably worth it.
Yep. Take it, boy.
Take it.
All right. I guess we'll move on to sort of our next talking point, which is looking at the future of the faction and where do we sort of see it adapt? Like, is this a faction, like, of the limited release factions that is capable of continuing to adapt and evolve based on what we see in the meta? Or do we think it's going to be a bit more like a Crucible Guard, where they've sort of remained a bit stagnant from release their popularity is sort of waning as a result?
I think this can evolve.
Yes. Again, like, so much of the design here is not at list building, it's during the game, so they can't become like Crucible Guard. Like, Crucible Guard need new releases, realistically, to sort of evolve, right? Because they're a classic War Machine faction. Infernals kind of don't. They would appreciate it. Like, let's just say there were more side-grade solos, right? Because when you get down to it, Infernal list is already packed, but you, like, have, like, other, like, Fallen Kovnik Joe, Fallen fucking, I don't know, some elf guy, right? Fallen Iris, why not? We'll go, like, crazy, okay? You can branch all those solos out, but you'd still be able to, like, you still wouldn't necessarily need them, and they probably wouldn't change the Infernal Core shtick because it's such a part of their faction identity.
Well, I mean, any release for one of the mainline War Machine factions at this point is an expansion to Hearts of Darkness.
Yes. Yeah.
Literally, I mean, every release they release for those factions going forward could potentially break the faction in some way. Because
like
we have Fiora no
4,
idea.
Right?
Broke Sorry? It again.
Yeah, Fiora 4.
Well,
she
we can
did
talk
it.
About that later, because I... But I'm just saying, because they literally usually really test and play test these models within the context of the themes that they're designed for these days, Hearts of Darkness is literally just like, do whatever you want, and hopefully we didn't break it.
Yeah. Well, which, not necessarily. I can't say that. Yeah, it's pretty much that.
James, I don't think they will, because it seems pretty unlikely, but it's really hard to say when you've literally just opened up the faction to be faction, along with a bunch of other models that weren't initially designed.
Yep.
I think it's worth going backwards half a step and just having a look at, what have limited factions looked like to date? When Infernals came out, were they slated to be, you know, the same thing? And what has the last, I think they came out, 9 months ago, 10 months ago now?
Thereabouts,
so what
yeah.
has that looked like? So you guys are much more knowledgeable on this than me, so...
I'm actually not certain if... I'm not sure this was a limited release faction.
No, it was 100% a limited release faction.
Was it? Okay.
Very, very much on front. And that was the thing, like, this is their third limited release, fourth limited release faction. And I think they've sort of nailed a formula with this one. They're designed in such a way that the way their mechanic is, like, is kind of adaptive and evolving. So they don't need to make as many releases for them to stay competitive. Like, presently, honestly, all they probably, if they, it's also like a hard faction to add releases to when you think about it. Like, think about it. What would happen if you added an extra light and an extra heavy to Infernals? It's not really like the Clockatress, right? Like, where they'd have to actually take it. So the Clockatress by its nature, has to be really strong in order to be having, right? Like, it wouldn't be the case with Infernals because, I mean, they would be competing with Tormentors, sure, and they're probably going to make it in such a way that whatever they released isn't, like, a strictly, like, it's now a Tormentor, but with three crabs, with three crab claws, so it's a strictly upgraded Tormentor. They're not going to do that.
So just thinking about limited factions for a second, sorry, Chris. Just thinking,
no, go on.
So we've had Crucible Guard that have really just had one release. Was it essentially 2017?
2018.
Yep. Cool. One sort of big release over the last almost 2 years. We've had Grimkin that were the year before that. 17?
Yep.
2017.
And then they had a release.
Second CID wave, right?
Yes.
And you've got Infernals and
Convergence. And Convergence had their release wave, so to speak, and hence why everyone is interested in Convergence again.
Yeah. So I always think about these things in terms of a business standpoint. And what the limited factions are a great sort of little like battery into the game, like a sizable chunk that people can take a bite of, get into the game and go from there. And I think Infernals do a good job of taking that a step further with Hearts of Darkness into existing things. My thoughts about what this actually means for the business are slightly different, though, because there are 15 factions in the game now, right? So if they bring out a new troll model, there's 1.5 factions that can use that. There's trolls, and then there's occasionally like sort of dominion-y overlap things. So that's 10% of your player base that will buy that model. So it's actually not a great product that you're buying when you're saying, well, we've already got so many people invested in the game, but 90% of them won't buy this model. So I think, again, that's another reason we've started to see these overlapping themes, Strange Bedfellows. We've got the Troll Minion one coming out later this year. We're going to see a bit of a overhaul of Legion. But also, if you look at something like Riot Quest, yes, it's Merc Christmas, but a lot of factions can make a lot of really good use of Riot Quest. Example, Circle with the Junior Archon has been a real hit lately. So I think we might actually, so using that logic, I think we might actually see, especially in the sort of golden era of board games, we might actually see some releases for Infernals that overlap in other factions. So what you alluded to earlier in terms of a caster that is both Infernal and another, but maybe more than just like, let's say, Kara 2, who might be able to play in Signar and Infernals. I think we might see something like even larger than that, like the expansion pack module I was talking about before. What that looks like, I'm not sure, but it's something a bit more homogenous that more player base have access to. Depends if they've learnt this lesson from a business standpoint or not.
Yep. Well, I think it's definitely on their mind, given...
Don't release troll models. Nobody can buy them.
Yeah, just don't do that.
Hey,
well, we already
fine.
Know
release
that they're going to.
Yeah,
along
they
with
are.
Pigs.
Yeah,
it's fine.
I mean, that's why they're splashing with major factions into the Minions and Mercs factions, because lots of people can pick up the models that work for both, and a lot of them are Minion Partisan Trolls in this case, or Kador Partisan, Mercs Partisan Kador, Mercs Partisan Convergence. And we're seeing a lot more of that, which means more people can pick these models up.
Yeah, I also certainly wouldn't be surprised if this kind of thought line has crossed their minds, considering we have, well, now quite a fair few cross-faction themes. Like, and the themes, I'm going to say, like, all the cross-faction themes so far, they've all been really fun. Like, they're limited enough that they've basically kept it from being too crazy pants out of control. They bring casters that you normally wouldn't see to the forefront, and they're a nice list-building exercise. It's fun to look at cross-faction synergy because for the longest time, it felt like such a black and dark art. It's a thing reserved for, like, forums when you're just like, ooh, but what if we could cross, like, this thing from Scorn with this thing from Trolls? Ooh. And now you're just like, well, let's do it. Let's go for it. Let's go. And it feels rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, a really good example of this is Gatsby 4, right? He's a well-priced module that you can pick up. He plays for Mercs, Cock, and Crix. You'll see him in a lot of lists. You'll also see him in the overlapping Strange Bedfellows list, I think. I might be wrong.
Yep, yes. But 100%. 100%.
Yeah.
but you, he's available to a lot more of the player base. So yeah, I guess I'd like to see that grow.
Yep. I mean, I think you're getting a wish regardless, one way or another. You know what? You know what? I'm just going to spitball this here. I kind of would like to see the next wave of Infernal stuff because, how should I put it? With Grimkin, their second wave of releases was primarily to fix their weaker theme, which was Bump in the Night. Hence, he had a bunch of, frankly, overpowered, busted shit for Bump in the Night. Right, well...
That was great.
It was good times. It was a good cast, that one. Well... I don't know necessarily as powerful, but in this case, like, an Infernal focus specifically on Hearts of Darkness. So, like, these kind of dual, like, Infernal slash their original faction kind of solos. And maybe use that as also a means of buffing up themes that previously basically have been left to the wayside a little, so to speak. So, easy example. Let's say there's, like, a Fyrus for a Temple Flame Guard, right? So, Temple Flame Guard is probably... like Menoth's least interesting theme, right? Cool, you can have a solo there who is a Flame Guard Infernalist who buffs Flame Guard but also does something in Hearts of Darkness that you'd want to bring in Model 2, that sort of thing. If you had that as a wave, that'd be fucking rad, and that would tick all the boxes there, and you'd be like, everyone starts having a field day and be quite have fun.
Yeah, I think that's like they're sort of hitting that quite well with Riot Quest. And I think that that's where you'll see a lot of that emerge now. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a pretty big tone back on actual War Machine releases of that nature, just to make room for a game that has like cross saleability. So people playing Riot Quest will buy them, and people playing War Machine will buy them, as opposed to just going down the hard. Let's make things that are like lots of War Machine players will like. I feel like that's probably not super like. Super the best way they can do this moving forward.
So speaking of Riot Quest, and we've already mentioned her once, does anyone have any thoughts about Fiora 4?
She's a cool model. I intend to buy her when she's released, and I'll use her in Riot Quest.
I don't think she's that useful in I think she's more useful in Menoth than in Infernals. I'm not really sure why everyone's losing their shit over her. Like when you get
why
down
would
to
you
it
say that?
Realistically,
yeah, Chris, why would you say that?
Because I like faithful masses, and I don't. Not gonna lie.
You like being triggered is what you like.
I definitely like to be. Look, I've actually got Menoth Archon sitting on my painting table. Okay, I've done it. Right.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, for the Vassal tournament we're playing, I literally was thinking at the last moment of just hole swapping to play Menoth because I'm like, well, I could play the first theme, the first list I've got here in either Kador or Menoth, so maybe we should play a good faction. I mean, a alternate faction instead of my usual Kador. Maybe, just maybe.
But Chris, can you imagine how many Vengeance tokens you get to put out if you play Fiora 4, though?
I mean, it's going to be about as many as, like, a good Twitter thread. So, yeah, I can see it. Man, as much triggering. It'd be great.
Fiora 4 does not really bring anything to Infernals that Infernals want. There, I said it.
That was my take on First Glance.
I don't know. I want to see, because it's not... They've already talked about it's not the final form, possibly.
Yeah. I'll wait. I'll reserve judgment, yeah, for sure.
But one of the things that I'm looking for in my Hearts of Darkness caster, and one of the things that I find that the other three of the Infernal Masses don't bring, and what I've always kind of looked for in my Hearts of Darkness caster, is someone who can play the long game starting at the early level. Which is what I always find is the easiest way to end up losing is when you lose the advantage in the early game.
Sorry,
so
yeah,
when
what
I look
do you
at
mean by that,
the
Brian?
Most successful
yeah,
casters.
I'm losing you there, man.
Sorry?
Like, can you just like clarify what you mean?
So when I'm playing with the three Infernal Masters, if you lose your advantage in the early game, it can be really hard to come back. And there are certain playstyles and certain casters in the game, which I'm sure you guys have talked about. My entire call got cut out during that period. Was that if you lose that early game really early, if they push their advantage hard, it can be really hard to come back from that. And I'm sure there are ways around that. But I find like there could just be a caster that would be much stronger in the early game and I was hoping that Fiora 4 would do this, but we'll have to see what it ends up being.
Not the early game.
No, the late game is where Infernals are the strongest.
Oh, okay.
If you're playing correctly. Yeah. It's when you lose your the early game that you have a hard time ever coming back to even play a late game.
Yeah, a 7 versus 5 heavy advantage on turn 3 is good. It is not as good as a 3 versus 1 heavy advantage on turn 7.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. Indeed. Does not make waves for me. We'll wait to see final form. I really like the idea of a Super Saiyan caster that powers up over the game. And the modding opportunities to be a little Goku, but I hate the idea that PP say, well, they power up, so better start with a wet noodle.
Yeah, she starts at power 12.
Start angry and get
angry. We did see Helga, I think, improve a little bit over that, but it's hard. I didn't pay that much attention, so it's hard to say. But there seems to be a lot of like decent rules for her on here, especially with her Field Marshal with free charges and then the access to free focus on all of her jacks.
It doesn't just seem that interesting, though, compared to, like... Well, the simple fact with Infernals is you already play such an insanely strong heavy game with Dark Legacy, so why would you want a War Machine version that also tries to do the same thing?
Well, I'm not saying she has to do it that way. I'm just saying that she has a... With a lot of War Machine casters, usually their battle group is one of the hardest things to fuel, so if you just take a bunch of models that are easy to fuel... It's not something you have to worry about. Plus, she gets to upkeep all of her spells on her battle group, and she has decent upkeeps in general, which are not just...
Unfortunately, things like Death March are wasted, though.
On
why wouldn't you just take a Menoth list almost at one point? To me, Fiora 4 is a 90% Menoth list with a flavoring of Infernals, if you can construct the list that way.
Yeah, sure. Whereas I actually really like your Fiora 3 idea, because I think, like... Umbral Guardians don't exist in Menoth, and boy howdy, do Umbral Guardians help out like Fiora.
Yeah,
Insight.
Was that what Heart of Darkness actually does? So, just really quick, your jacks get accumulator, you start with your upkeeps in play, and some wretches get some useless shit. And you can take three solos and two units from your sort of home faction. So, you can, if you construct it well, you can take the absolute like best of both worlds, but you are a little bit limited by that 3 and 2 restriction. But just real quick, for someone like Fiora 3, starting with Banishing Ward and Redline in play means that she can run 16 inches straight up the guts with Banishing Ward, relatively immune from shooting because you got D-Cell and a number of Guardians and things, and out of threat ranges and ask really tough questions, which maybe you can't in Menoth. I'm not as familiar with Menoth, so I don't know if I'm talking out my ass there. But...
I mean, I
agree. Menoth. I think Fiora 3 has a lot of potential that you don't have within Menoth just because they don't have the same options for protecting her or applying her buffs.
Well, it's also like you just can easily cross things again. Like you've got. When you're playing Fiora 3, you're also playing Sub-Zero, and we all know how much of a dickhead that guy is.
Yeah, that model's ridiculous. And Junior is ridiculous on top of that. Sorry, Tom, to go back to your very original question, I don't know what the future holds for Infernals, whether it's like another little expansion pack that is purely Infernals. I'd be surprised, because I think from a business perspective, they would have done their dash with the initial Infernal release. I don't know if I'd like to see more sort of like Hearts of Darkness approach. I'm thinking about all the stock on shelf that needs to be moved. I don't know. A fourth caster and maybe a new unit or something could be cool. Basically a Grimkin approach, but I think PP might have bigger priorities or bigger fish to fry.
Do you guys see a Colossal in the future?
I hope not.
Six essence.
It would unsummonable. It would definitely have. You can't at that point we're staring straight in the bleeding jaws of capitalism and just saying yes, daddy, please, right?
It's just not a flavor you particularly. I would particularly want in that faction.
The only way I can.
You thought summoning 7 heavy was hilarious. Imagine summoning 7 colossals.
You wouldn't be able to summon it very likely, unless they make it like a glass cannon that's easy to take off the table and bring back out.
No, I've got it, right? So in order to summon the Colossal, you have to have 5 marked souls, and they have to form a pentagram in the size of roughly a huge vase, and then you sacrifice all of them, and then you summon your Colossal. Boosh, done. Thank you. You can, you know, send me your royalties later.
But convoluted and hilarious.
Yes.
I don't know. It's just the only reason I ask is because they kind of alluded to it in the Henchild Scrolls a little bit.
Yeah, sure. They did, didn't they?
In terms of the future, I don't know. I hope that this faction sort of just gets... I would like to see a bit of a rotation through Hearts of Darkness. I think that could actually be quite interesting. Like, just, you know, from time to time, be able to shake up which casters are available in that faction, or even, you know, adding in, Menoth can take 3 units, but it can only take 1 Jack type scenario, or a Colossal, or whatever. I don't have a good solve for that, but just playing around with the format rather than the content itself.
Yeah. If I had to, like, construct a bucket list of things that I'd want, I think I'd want, number one, a limited War Machine format that will come at some point. Yeah. Number two, I'd actually prefer a new limited release faction, but I actually think I'd prefer something that crosses over a lot of existing things. So maybe it's like a zoo faction that pulls elements of Circle and Scorn into it, or something like that, that really attempts to put some boundaries on the game. Having said that, a third faction of like a zoo of like Wastelanders or whatever, that'd be cool too.
I would really like to. I love the flavor, and I love the sculpts we've gotten of like the Totem Hunter and Balthazar Bamfist from Riot Quest, so just like this wacky otherworldly type thing. It's kind of
absolutely
groovy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, indeed. Who knows what'll happen after Infernals? They do say the storyline will continue at some point. What they end up introducing could be interesting. I mean, they all the Iron Kingdoms have holdings in Zoo. They might end up pulling them all back as a method of reinforcing the nations after they've lost so much, and maybe that'll bring Zoo into the formula.
Yeah,
that would be really cool.
The future of War Machine is just everyone forced into play more Nebras. That's it.
Oh, shut up, Tom. What Infernals and the Hedgehog Scroll did for sort of like global enthusiasm and tying the story together with the game and Archons and stuff, that was really exciting. I really
enjoyed that. Was the potential to that see cannot be understated
in another form. That was awesome. So yeah,
actually,
I'd like to see.
Can I change my answer, James?
Yeah.
What I'd love to see is more campaign-based stuff like they did with Oblivion, and make it a little bit more accessible for stores and people to access for free in future. Because I think that War Machine has definitely got a name as a tournament-based game, and Infernals are really cool for that and all that sort of jazz. But I think that if you can get more people through the door, it's going to be people playing for a whole range of reasons, not just tournaments. And like they could go in hand in hand with like a limited format, but I think that these narrative events are really cool, and they sort of breed that enthusiasm into the game. And I would love to see PP sort of capitalize on that opportunity a little bit more.
You're not going to get what happened last year at Lock and Load, where Lord Carver just hijacked an airship, right? Like that kind of stuff doesn't happen except in a narrative campaign. So
yeah,
it with itself, like that's what you're after. And oh man, like. It might be that we were so starved for fluff, but I actually cared about Iron Kingdom's fluff for the first time in a long time with those Hedgehog Scrolls.
No, I think that's true for a lot of people.
But it's also like it was a very different style of it. It was just like it was basically like it was literally Ragnarok. Everything is going to shit. All the things are going. People are actually legitimately dying. Some of them are coming back, and it's just fucking mad.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Future is bright, I think, for that regard.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Anyhow, Infernals may have killed Khan, but they don't think they've killed the game itself. In fact, if anything, I think they've accidentally, inadvertently, put some life into it. If by no other reason than giving us a new problem to face. So.
Yeah. They summoned James back from whatever game he was playing.
Yeah.
I don't even know what I was doing, dude.
And I was gonna, I was literally just, I had to stop myself saying Guild Ball, but it probably was, it wasn't even Guild Ball. Yeah. Probably CrossFit. Or, yeah. It's probably CrossFit or something. Something lame.
CrossFit.
But seriously though, James, thank you so much for coming. I shouldn't be the one talking about this. Tom, do we have any more questions?
No, I'm out of, I thought that four questions was enough to get us through what I'm assuming is about 2 hours, 45 minutes at this point.
It is not quite that. It's 2 hours and 20, and I think it's a good time as any to stop. It also, I think, was an extremely good cast. Anyway.
I agree.
Thank you so much for casting. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us as well.
Thanks for coming on, James.
No, thanks for having me. Always appreciate it.
No drama. Oh. On that note.
What? No drama.
No drama.
No drama, boys.
No drama, boys. And on that note, I'd like to say goodbye, apparently. Anyway, thanks for listening. Good night.
Cool story.
Bye. Bro.
Good night, guys.
Okay, boom.